You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
Telling me I've got to beware.
So what's interesting is that when she asked me about what happened in the first edition, I said, well, it's right here, page 630 to 660, and I pull it up, and I find out that in this bound version of the book I have, there is nothing between 630 and 660. There are no pages. They're completely missing. The very pages that describe the suppression of the first book, first edition.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Gerard Colby. Today's show, DuPont, the secret political power. Gerard Colby is a freelance investigative journalist, author, and educator. He is the author of DuPont Dynasty, Behind the Nylon Curtain, co-author with Charlotte Dennett of Thy Will Be Done, The Conquest of the Amazon, Nelson Rockefeller and Evangelism in the Age of Oil, and a contributor to Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press, edited by Christina Borgeson. He is the past president of the National Writers Union. Jerry Colby, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Well, I'm pretty good, considering. You write that in the year 2000, the DuPonts celebrated their 200th year in America.
Mm-hmm.
Now a financial dynasty with a new corporate hierarchy, they are the richest family on earth, a family with a corporate empire that stretches over six continents of the world. The DuPonts of Delaware own more personal wealth and control more multimillion dollar corporations than any one family in the world. They employ more servants than Britain's royal family, own more yachts, cars, swimming pools, planes, and estates than any family in recorded history. Your book, The DuPont Dynasty, Behind the Nylon Curtain, took 5 years to research and 3 years to write. When was your book on the DuPonts first published, and how was it received?
Well, in the first edition came out in 74, the second edition came out in 84, and the current edition, which was just last year, came with a new introduction. The 74 book required me to go and move to Delaware and do my research there, and after I finished, I asked them for interviews. No one accepted. I went ahead, did the writing that I could, having done also research at the family library, the Lutheran Mills Hagley Foundation Library, above the Brandywine, old Brandywine mills, at the gunpowder mills that the family had in Delaware. So it turned out that as I was doing so, they launched an investigation of me, and got a knock on the door one day from a fellow who identified himself as a former Air Force man who was now writing a piece for Ramparts magazine, and gave me the name of a very good friend of mine, a writer in Dover, Delaware, and I checked him out, and he said, yeah. So I let him have access for this article in Ramparts to my files. It turned out he was not writing an article for Ramparts. I'd never heard of him, and I should have called them directly. But to make a long story short, he was actually an informer, former Air Force intelligence officer who was gaining access to my material and then turning over information on it to Richmond Williams, who was at that time director of the Lutheran Mills Hagley Foundation Library. Now, the library is a place where the DuPont family have stored all their family records, from their first report card right up to their death certificate, including their correspondence. But I didn't know that it became an ongoing intelligence center for the family. And this information then went right back to family members of the foundation that controlled it. And the next thing I knew is that when the book was being announced, behind my back, this fellow had enlisted my literary agent to write a book to respond to mine when it came out. My literary agent, I will freely tell his name, was Oscar Collier. He was subsequently removed from the Society of Authors Representatives, mostly for that reason. And he then proceeded to start to write. And meantime, my book was about to come out. It was announced by Prentice Hall, who was the original publisher. And they were having a big fanfare about it. Interesting enough, somebody in the company ordered a local salesman to deliver an unedited manuscript of the book to a DuPont family connected bookstore. It was a bookstore that had been owned by one of the DuPont family members. It's right around the area of around where the DuPont headquarters is. And then, lo and behold, in walked a man who was a major DuPont figure who picked it up, the DuPont family member now, and then delivered it right up to DuPont headquarters to the office of Irenae DuPont Jr., who was the family patriarch at the time. Irenae was senior vice president of DuPont Company and decided to use the company's resources to carry out this campaign against the book, and had a meeting with the public relations office. And the next thing we know is that he flew off. The only reason we know all this is because I sued them in federal court, and through discovery we got a lot of documents. And then we went down to Delaware and took their testimonies. It turns out that the book was then actually had an index developed, apparently by someone in Prentice Hall, for them to look at, and the they went through the book, and this is before the public has even seen the book. And then a series of threatening phone calls came down from the DuPont Public Relations Office to Book of the Month Club. That's because Book of the Month Club had selected it for its Fortune Book Club, and somehow they found, oh yes, I know, they found that because it was mentioned in the release by Prentice Hall. So they called the book actionable, scurrilous, had been looked by the family, and the warning was clear. And in 24 hours, in an unprecedented decision by Book of the Month Club, in such a short period of time, they decided to kill the contract. At which point, Prentice Hall officials got a hold of this information. They, of course, were told that, and they called DuPont. And DuPont denied that they were threatening anything, and the next thing you know, it's kicked upstairs to Prentice Hall executives, and they decide they're going to kill the book off. And the way it's done in the industry is they don't announce it that it's being killed off, of course. That would be a breach of contract. So what they do is they privish the book. That's the term used, to privately publish a book rather than publicly publish. And what that means is that you go through the normal actions that give the impression that they're living up to the contracts. But in reality, behind the scenes, they cut this print run by one-third so that, in their own words, it could not price profitably according to any conceivable formula. They cut the advertising. They cut the tour, the book promotion tour that's part of the contract. And they, at that point, they were deciding to just let this book die. So at that point, I was completely in the dark. And it was months went by. And finally, my editor over many martinis couldn't take it anymore. And he spilled the beans to me. And I said, look, his name is Bram Cavan, very decent man. I said to Bram, fine. You know, the DuPonts feel that way. That's fine. Let's go into a press conference. Let them come forward. And so he said, well, the company's not going to do that. And right away, I realized something was up with the company. At that point,
And the company you're talking about is Prentice Hall.
Prentice Hall, excuse me. And at that point, we had tried to touch base with a John Tompkins, who is a top journalist for Fortune magazine. Tompkins wrote a very interesting piece. I know that's what part of it. He contacted Book of the Month Club, contacted Prentice Hall, contacted DuPont, wrote a real meaty story about this, and next thing you know, they decided to kill it. The publisher wrote Fortune magazine. So the next thing that happens is that the book is taking off anyway, and they don't know what to do, apparently, because it got a rave review, two-page full New York Times Sunday book section review of the book, calling it something of a miracle, and on whacking sculpture over the side of the mountain, talking about promoting yourself a little bit, but and it actually happened. And they were very, and the New York Times revealed later on that they had come under pressure from right after that review appeared by DuPont company officials, saying, you know, you don't know anything about journalism, you should sign it to someone that knows something also about business, and we don't think there's anything new in the book at all, which is the standard line when someone, you know, someone pay attention to anything that's written in it. And it turned out that New York Times editors actually stood up to them and said, look, if you want to come up and talk about this, but otherwise we don't agree with you. We think there's a lot in there that's completely different. And they responded and said, oh, no. And then they wrote in their private memoranda that it's the best that they could probably get out of them. Well, at that point, not knowing that this was all going on, but emboldened by the New York Times review and the rave reviews it was getting around the country, that Prentice Hall's own attorney, chief counsel by the name of William Daly, couldn't take it anymore. He had never seen anything like this in his entire career. And he said, anyway, and he picked up his file and did something that legally could have been disbarred for. I don't know why he did it, but he did it because he wanted to get the truth out, I guess. And he went down to the New York Times with the file and turned it over to Alden Whitman. And Alden Whitman wrote up the story, which appeared in late January of 1975 on the same day that another story appeared about how DuPont had put pressure, the DuPont family put pressure to eliminate some of the top editors and journalists at the Wilmington News Journal, which they controlled, because they were getting too close to the family and starting to talk about what was going on with the family. So at that point, meantime, the book has been out and people are ordering more copies and they can't get them from Prentice Hall. So the book is essentially dead. It dies. You know, impulse dying around Christmas time is key. So I then went back to my literary agent, and I said, not, you know, completely innocently, and I said to him, you know, well, we've got to fight back. We've got to do something. And he tells me, well, Chair, the book is at its run. Well, to tell you a little, subsequently happened within months, my editor was fired. He was replaced by my literary agent as a senior editor at Prentice Hall. So it's a small world. So what I did is then eventually after a year of trying to deal with this issue through other literary agents, I decided to go to federal court and challenge them. So I filed a breach of contract against Prentice Hall and an inducement of breach of contract legal action against DuPont. Resulted in my going down to Delaware, taking testimony of everybody, including the governor of Delaware, and dealing with a lot of problems. Lots of money, of course, pretty much almost bankrupted me and my wife, really. And it turned out that we ended up getting back the rights to the book, as well as a decision by the lower court, the federal district court, that Prentice Hall had indeed been guilty of privishing the book. Now, but he let DuPont off. Now, here's an interesting story about that. There I am in the middle of the trial, and Aaron A. DuPont Jr. gets up onto the stand wearing his DuPont belt buckle, which he's very proud of.
He has a DuPont belt buckle?
Belt buckle, yes. I remarked, I said, I really like your belt buckle when he came in for his deposition with it. And he said, yes, I'm very proud of it.
What does it say? Better living through chemistry?
Yes, that's true. Better living as a DuPont through chemistry. So he went into his discussion in the court, and then he was trying to read a document, and the judge who's the third judge we had been given, two had recused themselves, one actually after being on the case for a year and then suddenly discovered he had a conflict of interest. And this last judge was Charles Bryant, who's not with us anymore. And Bryant got up from the die, you know, where the judge sits, and came down the stairs and walked over to Irene and turned on the light for him. And I turned to my attorney and I said, "Big trouble, boy." Well, the day before the trial ended, the judge called all the counsel into his chambers and wagged his finger at my attorney and said, "I'm not going to find a pillar of American society guilty for merely expressing their point of view about a book about them." But my attorney turns and says, "But, Your Honor, this was also scurrilous, actionable. That's a threat of lawsuit. That's more than just expressing a point of view." And he says, "Well, I don't care. I'm not going to buy this as an inducement to breach a contract, and I'm not going to find a pillar of American society guilty of anything." So that's that. "But you, he says, to Prentice Hall, the judge says, "You, if you're going to publish a book like this, you're going to publish it. You're not going to privish it." So, of course, Prentice Hall immediately scurried back after that conference, made a bunch of phone calls, their lawyers did, and they came to me and my attorney, and they said, "Well, look, we'll settle with you." And they were willing to pay me essentially the equivalent of what we had paid to get up to this point in legal costs. The only proviso was that I keep my mouth shut about what had happened and what had gone on.
That's always the case with these kind of cases, isn't
it? Yes. And I turned around and I said, "Forget it." Mm. So the next day, the trial ended, and sure enough, Charles Bryan came down finding Prentice Hall guilty. Well, Prentice Hall appealed. We appealed on the DuPont decision against us, and that went up to the appeals court, which voice there were three judges there, and my attorney walked up and saw two of them scowling, and one of them, Sterry Waterman of Vermont, I will say, unfortunately, sleeping, literally nodding off in sleep. And his clerk came up to me years later at a Vermont Bar Association dinner and said to me how apologetic he felt about all this, and I really hadn't gotten my shot in court. Of course, the two other judges, one had been appointed by Nelson Rockefeller, and the other one had been had clerked for a judge in Delaware who had just been charged with suppressing evidence of asbestos poisoning of DuPont workers, something which I talked about in my book, too. And so you think he might recuse himself for a bit of a conflict of interest, but he didn't, and wrote a scathing review reversing the award I had won from Prentice Hall, wagging his finger and calling the book, attacking it for political reasons. And at that point, the ACLU stepped in. And by the way, it was dismissed. So we appealed then to the Supreme Court. Professor Lawrence Tribe of Harvard stepped in and thought this was an outrage, and they took the case to the Supreme Court on the grounds that the judge now had become a censor against the first. And there was no error of fact, no error of law, standards, or anything that he had found. Instead, it was just his political opinion. Because of the political view of this book, obviously non-establishment, it would never find a market in the United States, even though all the sales records of Prentice Hall said otherwise. So all I can tell you is that it got as far as the Rehnquist Court, and then the Rehnquist Court refused to hear it. Rehnquist being one of my favorite people, as you can gather.
I'm speaking with freelance investigative journalist and author Gerard Colby. Today's show, DuPont, the Secret Political Power. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So as a result of that, however, the second edition came into being around the same year that decision came down. Another edition came out. I had won back the rights to the book. My publisher was Lyle Stewart of New Jersey, formerly of New York. Lyle came forward and said, "Look, I'll do everything to support you on this, and all you have to do is write your heart out. Bring things up to date." So I did. I wrote another 400 pages. He put it all together, and it came out with a full-page ad in the New York Times.
Now, Jerry, are we in the 1980s now?
We're now in 1984.
Okay, so like 10 years later.
That's correct. The whole court case went up and said, actually 77 to 81. Then the first decision came down in 81, and then the appeals court provisions all went right up to the Supreme Court up to 84. So at that same year, a new edition of the book comes out with Lyle Stewart. And, you know, it was a pretty good edition, I must say. There's a lot more in there. I brought it up to DuPont's involvement in pushing for the elimination of the Glass-Steagall Act, Pierre DuPont's preparations for his campaign for the presidency in 1988, which indeed came about, the move against environmental laws, the involvement with the CIA in the Contra War. All the evidence is there in the book, as well as a discussion about what happened to the first book, naming names, bringing it all forward, and backing up with court documents. So lo and behold, there I am. And suddenly, Lyle Stewart gets a phone call, and it's from Prentice Hall. They say, we want to come down and depose you. And Prentice Hall and Lyle Stewart says, why? He says, because we want to know something about that. We're trying to get back court costs from Colby. Now, this is the first time I'd heard about it. So they show up, and they start to ask questions. And Lyle brings down Joe Rao's law firm, a very famous firm in New York. And they start asking questions. They wanted a copy of the names of his drivers and a copy of the manuscript. And he turns to them and says, this is obviously an attempt to interfere with this book. And he says, and by the way, who are these two other men that just walked through the door and are sitting in the back? And they, oh, says Prentice, well, that's DuPont. We thought they'd be interested in this. He says, uh-huh. Joe Rao turns in and says, we're out of here. They walked out on him. And Lyle put out in his newsletter what had happened. But it never got into the press. So the next thing, the book comes out, full-page ad, like I said, and he's starting to collect orders. He's happy as can be. And I'm down at the Financial News Network on Wall Street explaining in an interview what happened to the first edition and after they asked me about it, and explaining also some of the machinations of the family around moving out and in and out of DuPont Company and buying up Conoco, Continental Oil Company, and other things. So what's interesting is that when he asked me about what happened in the first edition, I said, well, it's right here, page 630 to 660, and I pulled it up, and I find out that in this bound version of the book I have, there is nothing between 630 and 660. There are no pages. They're completely missing. The very pages that describe the suppression of the first book, first edition. So I get off. I do my Jackie Gleason, go hubba hubba hubba, you know, and we talk about other things. And I got off, and I got on the phone and talked to Char, my wife, and I said, Char, these pages are missing from the. Could you take a look at the books that Lyle gave us? And she did, and she came back and said there were 10 copies. She said, yeah, Jerry, about three of them don't have any of those pages. I said, what? Call Lyle. Lyle says, I'll check into it immediately. Calls the warehouse. They discovered that of the 10,000 print run, one quarter of them had been damaged by that, so that orders could not be filled. I ask, who printed this book? And he tells me the name of the company. And I'll look into this, Jerry. And next thing you know, the same exact thing is happening to this edition because orders that are coming in can't be fulfilled. After a while, people wait long enough. They say, well, they're going to go somewhere else.
Wow.
So that book died. He tells me when he finally gets back to me, he says to me, well, the book... All I can tell you, Jerry, is that the publisher gets, we now discover, gets 80% of their business from Prentice Hall. So at that point, I didn't hang up my spurs, but I certainly, there wasn't much I could do about a book that people can't buy. So I went through a personal effort to promote the book, and next thing, the book was dead. Then, years later...
But, well, wait a minute. So yeah. Then you don't have any legal standing? I mean, you couldn't force them to reprint the book? I mean, somebody has to be held accountable, don't they, for the fact that the run was ruined?
Yeah, that's what you would think. But Lyle Stewart died then.
Oh.
And then on his court records, in his estate, titles, because he owed some money, titles were transferred over to other publishing houses. We got a complete list through the National Writers Union of all the names of the books that were transferred over. My book was not one of them. So I waited to see if there was anything from his wife. No, and then I tried to contact them, and I didn't get any response. So at that point, I was on another case. I was desperately trying to finish another book on the CIA and the Amazon. another happy topic. And in the course of doing so, I at least held the electronic rights. And lo and behold, here we are 20 years later, 30 years later, and I'm approached to write another introduction for an electronic version of the book, and that's what we have now.
What a story. It's really unbelievable. And, of course, if this has happened to you, it must have happened to others as well.
As a matter of fact, it's one of the reasons I was involved in helping found, with my colleagues, the National Writers Union in 1981. American Writers Congress had been formed. We expected about maybe 300 writers, and said about 3,000 of them showed up. And out of that, we formed the National Writers Union, which became affiliated later with the United Auto Workers. And we were fighting for freelance rights, including the promotional rights, the film and contractual obligations, and so on. It's a very big, difficult industry to take on. The publishing industry has never been unionized, except in a couple of the publishing houses. Some of the typists have been organized, but other than that, there is no trade union representation to speak of in the publishing industry. And they run the show, and they dictate terms to authors. As a matter of fact, one of the issues is around electronic rights, where the publishers were starting to take our electronic rights and resell them over the internet, and without any compensation to us. And we didn't believe that when we signed a print contract that included electronic rights. We went to the federal courts again, and this time, with a union behind me and behind other authors, we won. Supreme Court came down with a decision saying electronic rights are the rights of the authors and a separate contract has to be negotiated for them. Mm. Well, then the publishers just simply turn around and instituted an all rights contract. In other words, if you want to get published at all, and they all do this now, you have to surrender all your rights, including electronic rights. And I've heard these words, throughout the world and in the universe, in all future formats to be intended.
Oh.
So welcome to the world of freelance writers.
Well, you know, it's interesting because people look at the internet as this a beacon of freedom, but it sounds to me like they're covering themselves on that if you want to get published at all.
Yeah, well, they're moving very fast. They want it all locked up behind them.
Oh, my goodness.
Even though there's copyright law that says it's in the hands of the author, you know, but they just are muscling over everything as fast as they can.
Well, now, I've been reading your e-version, of course, of the DuPont Dynasty, and that is over 800 pages long and extremely comprehensive. It really includes a whole history of the United States. How did you first become interested in the DuPont family?
Well, I was working for a congressman as his press secretary, John Dow of New York, in 1968. He was a supporter of Bobby Kennedy, and I had done a little organizing for Bobby Kennedy's presidential campaign when John asked me to take on the position. And he was the congressman in my district, and I said, sure. Did so, and in the course of doing so, we also researched who he was obviously running against. The guy who was challenging him for the congressional seat, and John was an anti-war congressman, was a former commandant of the American Legion. And going through his donations that had just become available, I noticed quite a few checks written out of Delaware. So that got me interested. And then I realized that the DuPonts, since the riots that accompanied Martin Luther King's assassination in March of that year. Would you remember those $50 million worth of damages in Detroit? Well, in Wilmington, Delaware, it was 50,000. But it's so scared, the establishment in Delaware, that they call out the National Guard. In that time, in the process of going through what would become the longest peacetime occupation of an American city by armed troops, the National Guard running up and down the black, I shouldn't laugh at this, up and down the black and Hispanic community with machine guns mounted on top of Jeeps. A real terror campaign. And people were being killed. It became a national scandal, but I was very interested in this family. I started to look more into them. I found out they were the original Gunpowder Trust. They were the ones who made $250 million off World War I and war contracts in profits. That they built their chateaus and huge estates in northern Delaware in the rolling hills of fox hunting country. And were called a species of outlaw by even the Secretary of War, Newton Baker, for overcharging for the explosives. They provided a huge percentage of the explosives that were fired by the Allies in World War I. Then they went on to make the similar gains. So anyway, I read more and more about this family. I said, oh, my God, what's going on here? So anyway, after John lost that election, we just couldn't match a lot of those funds. Then I went back to school. I had taken a leave and was expecting to go into the draft. But fortunately, the draft decided otherwise, and I ended up outside waiting to figure out what I'm going to do, and decided then I would go to Delaware and research to see if there was a book here in the family. And sure enough, when I got there, I wasn't there more than, I'd say, 6 months. When I discovered so much that I realized this is a story that has to be told. It's a family that considers themselves the armors of the Republic and alias the guardians of the Republic. Very, very right-wing, conservative. A family that never made a graduation politically into what the high finance people do. You know, they become more liberal. They have a lot more flexibility to move their capital around. But that's not the same with a family that's an industrial gentry and can't move beyond their industry, and that the DuPonts have never gained control of a major bank, even though they sat on some of the boards of them. They held a minority controlling interest. And as you know, in a major corporation, it's very, very hard to do anything without making sure that you have enough support on a board. A 5% holding, according to Congressman Wright Patman of the Banking Committee, was a controlling interest in the company. So I looked into those, and I said, oh, my God, the family is the wealthiest family in America at that time, 1984. They're not the wealthiest today, but they were the wealthiest then at $10 billion. Nobody compared to them. So right-wing politics, right from the old, they always wanted to reverse the New Deal, which they never accepted, even though one of their family members married Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Jr., but they were absolutely livid about Roosevelt and the New Deal and the reforms for labor, the reforms for banking, including the Glass-Steagall Act, which prevented commercial banks from speculating in the stock market. As you know, that was repealed, and the DuPonts were involved in encouraging its being repealed by Congress. And the result is that, well, I'll tell you, it goes even further, because when I finished that book and I was in the middle of all this, I knew in 84, and I wrote about it, that Pete DuPont was making his move for the presidency. Well, he had a foundation, a fundraising foundation, GOPAC.
Now, Pete DuPont at that time was what? Was he the governor of, Delaware?
That's absolutely correct. He was the governor of Delaware. He had been congressman. He had actually been involved in some of the operations around attacks on the book when the book came out in Delaware and became a number one bestseller. And there was a whole campaign that was raised against the publisher of the Delaware State News, the only non-DuPont daily newspaper in the state, who had published a serial version of it. And this all came out later in the course of the investigation around the trial. But the key here is that Pete DuPont was then making his move, and he decided decided to turn GOPAC, the government, I think Government of the People Action Committee, if they can call it, GOPAC, over to a rising star who shared his right-wing views, and that was a man by the name of Newt Gingrich. And then he went on and encouraged Newt to expand it and develop it, and the DeVant family was bankrolling it. And he went on to run for the presidency in 1988. He lost. His platform, however, was adopted pretty much by Newt Gingrich in the House of Representatives and became the basis of what later was known as the Contract with America, although I would call it the Contract on America. He was instrumental, of course, in the 1994 so-called Republican Revolution that put Newt Gingrich into the Speaker's position. So a lot of people don't realize that behind all this attacks on New Deal reforms all these years has been not only the DuPonts, but they've also been behind Newt Gingrich, too. So they have pretty much succeeded, except for labor, although they really have curtailed a lot on that end. And the more that they can attack the unions in this country, there is no other defense against the closing of plants, the lowering of wages, the layoffs of workers, the deindustrialization of America that has taken place, except in a very high-tech form or in the low-paced service. But there's no question that the technological unemployment that's going on is being hidden in the United States in the ghettos, although it's now spreading out into the white suburbs as well, and we're seeing the restlessness that's going on in the country right now.
I'm speaking with freelance investigative journalist and author Gerard Colby. Today's show, DuPont, the Secret Political Power. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. DuPont is a name commonly associated with paint, nylon, and chemicals. How outdated is this description?
Quite. Actually, they started out in munitions. They were the biggest munitions maker in the United States. In the 1930s, they were engaged in contracts with companies like IG Farben, which was then known to be rearming the Wehrmacht of Hitler. They moved into nylon and chemicals in the 19 and General Motors just before World War One. By the 1920s, one of them, Pierre DuPont the second, had become chairman of General Motors. His treasurer, John J. Roskob, became a major figure in the finance committee of General Motors as well. They then were involved in fighting against the unionization of the UAW by the UAW and the great sit-down strike. Fortunately, President Roosevelt said, no, we're not going to call the troops out on these people. And the DuPonts were forced out of active management. They handed it over to, the guy's name escapes me right now. But they did retain their holding until an antitrust suit was brought against them by the Supreme Court. So they've been in Motors. They've been in U.S. Steel as well. They left there. They were in aviation. As a matter of fact, we have a guy up here called Tony DuPont, Anthony DuPont. He's actually an older member of the Klan, who was run for the House of Representatives. Fortunately, he was defeated. The family then moved into finance as much as they could, which was only their local bank, Wilmington Trust, which became the subject of a lot of problems after the 2008 financial crisis, which was hidden from the public when they were trying to decide how they were going to find a bailout on this. And eventually what they did, they got out of Wilmington Trust. The public really didn't know about how bad the condition was of the bank. And then the family then has moved on into clipping coupons and bonds. And the other part, however, is the company has moved also into genetically modified seeds. Now, they still have a holding in DuPont, but interestingly enough, the major holding is now by major venture capital funds. They're essentially now just collecting the dividends, maybe diversifying their holdings again. as you know, they were involved for a while in Phillips Petroleum, the Continental Oil Company, all sorts of banks, but they had never controlled the major bank, and still don't. You probably know about the genetic, about the seed question and how that's created a lot of controversy again about this so-called second green revolution, selling seeds at an expensive price to governments who then, in developing countries, who then pay for the seeds with subsidies and grants from the Agency for International Development, in other words, the U.S. taxpayer, and then they distributed them at a discounted amount to the farmers, who were then told that they have to realize that they cannot reproduce these seeds, that they're under control of the of DuPont Company. The other part is they're involved in politics. Apparently, they have been involved in defeating the California labeling law.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Yeah, Proposition 37, I think it
was. That's right. That's right.
What, they put money into that?
That's right. And a few trade associations. And, you know, this is a company that will not go away, and the family, it's still based in, of course, Wilmington, Delaware, and the family is still very much involved in building its fortune and therefore its wealth and its power. People think they can walk away from these people or just ignore them as they get their wealth as long as the pie gets bigger for everybody else. But now we know not only is the pie not getting bigger for everybody else as they expand their interests abroad, but more importantly, that wealth is not neutral. It turns into power for these people, which makes people are now waking up to what they call the 1% of America that controls so much of its wealth and power. DuPont, by the way, was second in the second largest donor to lobbying efforts for the GMO legislation. They gave $4 million on that, right behind Monsanto.
What do you mean, the legislation that would legalize the GMOs?
It was actually to defeat the California's GM labeling law. That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, I see. I see. Now, everyone knows about Monsanto, and
right,
that's
but they
very...
don't know about DuPont.
No, I've never heard that about DuPont.
Yeah, I've had people, because they're a very secretive company. They're very careful about what they do. Their PR division is very good. I knew one of my best friends in Delaware, worked with them for 35 years. He was so disgusted that he gave me his GM pin that they gave him with his pension. A very decent man by the name of Ted Keller, who headed up the Delaware Coalition for Tax Reform, trying to go after DuPont's and the banks who had been given a huge tax break when they all moved in. You know, the escalating rates of credit cards and all that you're getting right now, a lot of this comes out of Delaware. Governor DuPont pushed through a law that was actually written by lawyers for J.P. Morgan Company and Chase Manhattan. I think it was called the Financial Improvement Act or something along those lines. Anyway, it allowed for interstate banking out of Delaware for credit card companies who could actually increase interest rates retroactively. So,
and now, if it was Governor DuPont who put it through, then you're talking about back in the 1980s.
Yeah, talking about in the 80s, and then it spread throughout the country from there. I had a big battle here in Vermont over it, too.
Yes, well, now, Delaware is a credit card company haven, isn't it?
Yeah, as a result of that bill.
And now, Joe Biden, of course, he represented Delaware, right,
mm-hmm.
in the Senate. And then what, his son, Beau Biden, wasn't he attorney general in Delaware?
That's correct. And he was attorney general at the time when a guy by the name of Richards, who's a DuPont, got off for twice for sexually molesting two of his children. And they decided to let him off even though he had been found guilty twice. And he wasn't given a court sentence. It would be just they couldn't figure out how he would be helped by jail time.
Well, now, with regard to Joe Biden, then Senator Joe Biden, there was a very famous change in the bankruptcy laws, as I recall, when he was representing Delaware, and Joe Biden was instrumental in this change in the bankruptcy laws. Now, what does that have to do with Delaware? Were the DuPonts involved in that?
The DuPonts were involved in everything. up there. They control the legal system through the Delaware Bar Association. The head of it in those days was Edmund Carpenter, who was a DuPont. Edmund Carpenter was involved also in my case. It's another little story, but I'll let you pass on that one. They're very powerful. By the way, they gave money mostly to Republicans, but sometimes to Democrats as well, but very seldom. It's mostly the Republicans. They control a good part of the politics in the 80s, 90s, and right up until this period. It's really very clear that they still have a lot of influence and will continue to have influence over the political process in Delaware.
You write that, quote, it is a syndrome, this reliance on the wealthy to run the economy and control government policies,
yeah,
long seen in American society. How much power has the DuPont family had over the U.S. economy? And we're talking about 200 years here.
Well, you've become the wealthiest family of America by the 1980s by obviously being involved at the heart of the American economy. If you're involved in gunpowder, that ultimately started to lead them to experiments in cellulose. Cellulose, in turn, led them into plastics. Plastics, in turn, led them into nylon. Nylon, is very useful in war and war contracts for everything from parachutes to whatever you want to imagine. But more importantly is that the family was able to use its money to branch into, like I said, U.S. Steel, United Fruit Company, the very famous company that pulls off coups in the Banana Republics of Central America, if it could get away with it, General Motors, Hercules Powder, Atlas Chemicals, and a slew of other companies that are identified. There is, I think there are over maybe 40, 50, probably even more than that, identified in the book. So if they can influence a judge merely by their name in New York, supposedly, I don't believe it, but supposedly has liberal courts, judges, you can imagine what they do. You know, they sat on the First National Citibank, which became Citicorp. They sat on the board of Chemical Bank. They have the power through not only purchasing stock, but also making deposits by DuPont Company. And, you know, when they drop, you know, $40, $50 million on a deposit inside a bank, it gives them power. They don't even have to sit on the board if they don't want to. And on top of that, they have, you know, this family's been around for, over 200 years now. They've married into some of the wealthier families in the United States, at least. So, for instance, they married into the Bissell family. They married into the Bancrofts, the Deans, the Stablers, the Edmonds, the Lairds, the Dardens. You know, Darden was Governor Darden of Virginia and sat on the board of Newport Shipbuilding Company. They married into the Carpenters, who in turn are married into the Phelps and the Morgans. It's a small world. It's a small world. The Sharps, the Byrds, the Evans, the Braden's, the Potters. And if you go through the list of the companies that are involved with them, you can see not only where their instruments are that they can switch off and on, but also they're in some key industries. For instance, they ran into atomic energy. They were the ones who helped build, I'll put it that way, the atomic bomb for the Manhattan Project. As a matter of fact, in Deepwater, the Deepwater plant in New Jersey, if you ever go over the Delaware Memorial Bridge heading south, if you look directly to your right, you'll see this city of lights right by the river. Well, that's the DuPont Deepwater plant. In the 1920s, it was exposed by Nation magazine, but other sources, as being the source of what they called poisoning of DuPont workers. Matter of fact, it had a reputation called the House of Butterflies because the workers, not realizing they were being poisoned by the fumes, were reaching up and trying to grab butterflies that didn't exist. Some of them who died were rushed off to a local hospital in Salem, New Jersey. The family had and the company had given them money. It was all hush-hush until finally the Nation and other sources broke it. That plant then became the center of the production for the actual uranium work that was done for the atomic bomb during World War II. That plant still now is listed as one of the major and most serious cleanup sites for the EPA. And as you see, how many years we're still waiting for them to clean it up. I don't know if they ever will. They also ran the Hanover plant up in Washington, which was the big nuclear production plant up there.
Well, yes. Now, that's the nuclear plant that's on the Columbia River, right?
That's correct.
I mean, that's still there, isn't it?
Yes, it's still there, but I'm not sure if it's still functioning. The same is true of the Savannah River plant, where there have been spills into the river. But you can go right through. I mean, I can take you up on a tour of Delaware River itself and just point out one DuPont plant after another. Plants that had been charged with being the largest polluters in the United States, dropping everything from PCBs to, well, you can imagine, you know, heavy metals. And that's true also over in Ohio and West Virginia. You know, you probably heard about the cases there that forced DuPont to actually pay off a lot of people. I mean, we're talking about not millions, not tens of millions, but hundreds of millions of dollars in settlements. Then you can talk about Benlate, you know, their weed killer, and how that destroyed the crops of farmers all over the United States and brought them into a position where they had to pay out, again, a couple hundred million dollars in settlements. You know, what they do is they rush these products forward without testing them to see for their impact on the environment or on human health. And they're doing the same now with genetically modified seeds. This is not like in the old days of Harold Ickes or Morgenthau, the farmer who became Secretary of Agriculture and then became Vice President of Roosevelt. These are not people that, you know, do natural modification, hybrid corns and so on. These are people that are going into the very structure of life and restructuring them into organisms that have never been seen on Earth before, and they're patenting them. They're saying they own them. And that's the basis for their now push into the third world with these, what we would call in the old days the third world, but now is essentially the underdeveloped world, pushing these single unicrop approaches through patented seeds. As I said, that the AID is, by the way, I should also mention something else. The Agency for International Development had a private enterprise office, which is, I understand, is still open. Its first director was Governor DuPont's wife, Elise. In the 80s, this was the company that pushed and insisted that any loans that were given abroad would be accompanied by a privatization drive, whereby governments would be forced to start to sell off their public enterprises, even if those public enterprises are turning a profit, and open the grounds for either the multinational corporations of America come moving in or for their junior partners playing a role down in Latin America and other places. So the DuPonts have been involved in that as well. I think you get the idea that we're not just talking about paints. We're talking about real power. And if anybody has any doubts about this, I invite them to just do a Google on DuPont Company and then do a Google on the DuPont family. And then finally, if you're ever in Delaware, travel through northern Delaware and take a look at the estates and these huge chateaus that sit on top of mountains and are surrounded by so-called farms for which they get tax breaks. Or the beautiful horticultural scenes that they've created for themselves. And then when they die, they turn them into foundations dominated by their families that they can still have enjoy, and they open to the public. So they get tax-free foundations in which they then bank a lot of their holdings, their families' holdings. You know, so it's a real racket, what I can tell you.
Do the DuPonts pay their fair share of taxes?
Oh, God. Of course not. But, I mean, that's a really old story. Since the 1890s, the DuPonts were involved in shaping corporate law through providing very lenient requirements for a corporation to set up shop. You didn't even have to have a workplace. All you had to do was open an office. It was like Delaware was like a Cayman Bank, you know, or in the Bahamas, where you have an office with a brass plate outside the office, you know, saying who you represent. And that's where a lot of money is parked. Well, in those days, it was Delaware. And then when the credit card companies all cut their deals with Governor DuPont, they moved into Delaware. And they got huge tax breaks. And even DuPont Company was given huge breaks in Delaware from something called a fixtures tax, where they were given a lower rate than any other industries. So you get the idea. And that's what, by the way, Ted Keller was spent all of his retiree years, decades, fighting but not succeeding in doing so. Nobody would touch that, including Biden. What can I tell you? By the way, Biden's son was the one that let this, as attorney general, that was overseeing that case of Richards, the child molester.
Jerry Colby, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking with Gerard Colby. Today's show has been DuPont, the Secret Political Power. Gerard Colby is a freelance investigative journalist, author, and educator. He is the author of DuPont Dynasty, Behind the Nylon Curtain, co-author with Charlotte Dennett of Thy Will Be Done, The Conquest of the Amazon, Nelson Rockefeller and Evangelism in the Age of Oil, and a contributor to Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press, edited by Christina Borgeson. He is a former president of the National Writers Union. DuPont Dynasty, Behind the Nylon Curtain, has been published as an e-book, available online at the Forbidden Bookshelf at openroadmedia.com and in Kindle at amazon.com. Email Gerard Colby at gcolby7777@gmail.com. That's G-C-O-L-B-Y, the numbers 7777@gmail.com. Guns and Butter is produced and edited by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaro Mako, and Tony Rango. To make comments or order copies of shows, email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Visit gunsandbutter.org to sign up for our newsletter and check out the blog for important articles and the opportunity to comment and share with other listeners. Follow us on Twitter at G&B Radio.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, part one of a new and very good speech by Michael Parenti. It's called Capitalism Versus Reality, and it's well worth a listen. I hope you'll stay tuned. Political scientist Michael Parenti is now 82. On October 16, 2015, he was in fine form, speaking at the University of Illinois' Springfield campus. Last November, New World Notes played selections from Parenti's Q&A there. And today and next week, we'll play the speech itself. It's titled Capitalism Versus Reality, and I think it's one of Parenti's best. It's about capitalism and the fight for democracy. Parenti says that democracy was not brought into being by capitalism. Far from it. Democracy was created through great struggle by the people as part of their fight to reduce their political and economic oppression and improve their lives. In fact, capitalism has fought against democracy every step of the way, and it continues to do so. So also did capitalism's predecessor forms of plutocracy. To argue these points, Parenti takes us back to the Constitutional Convention. Then he takes us back even further, to the ancient Athens of Cleisthenes and the Hoplites, then up to the recent past and the present. Here is Michael Parenti.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Pleasure to be here. I was going to talk about capitalism versus reality. And what I meant was I was going to criticize, and I am going to criticize, the dominant ideologies that hold the system upon us. The dominant orthodoxy today is that the free enterprise system, or capitalism as we know it, has given us democracy and it has given us prosperity. I want to argue that it has given us neither of those two things. In fact, democracy, both economic and political, democracy emerged not along with the growth and accumulation of wealth and capital, but in reaction to it, in resistance to it. The Constitution itself is a document born of that struggle. The founding fathers, or framers, or delegates to Philadelphia in 1787, those founders who put together and wrote the Constitution, they were rich merchants, they were bankers, landowners, and more than one-third of them were slaveholders. Who else, I ask you, who else could spend 4 months in Philadelphia from May to the middle of September 1787 writing a constitution? The dirt farmer can't do that. The servant and the household servant can't do that. The slave working in the field can't do that. He can't even leave his plantation. Who can do that? Only the rich and the well-born, as they called themselves. That's Alexander Hamilton's statement, that the country should be led by the rich and the well-born, meaning us guys. And all the other guys are, us, that's right. They didn't exactly say it that way. But what you had at this convention, and if you go to Philadelphia, this convention hall is still preserved, you know, to this day, or been restored. What you had there was one individual named James Madison. And what Madison did was all during the convention, he kept taking notes. And at night, the other guys would go off to an inn or something. He'd go back to his room, and he would transcribe the notes. So we have this remarkable document, Madison's Notes on the Constitutional Convention. I read the whole thing. I went through the whole thing, in which these people, thinking they are speaking in secret because they got the windows sealed off, the room closed in. Imagine the middle of Philadelphia summer, sealing off the rooms with all these delegates jammed in there. And they are putting together a constitution in secrecy. Madison records their remarks, and he joins in. He says the common people are not to be trusted, and the common people are irresponsible. He moved a little bit more over to Jefferson's side on that. He loosened up a little on that in the next couple of years. But most of the people there, of course, did not change. Those who own the land should rule it. That was John Jay who said that one. So they don't pull any bones about it. They don't make any bones. They pretty much come right out and say what it is. Madison, again, in Federalist Paper number 10, which he published out to the public, the most common and durable source of faction, and by faction he didn't just mean little groups or cliques breaking up. He meant class factions, farmers against merchants, against bankers or something like that. The most common and durable source of faction is the various and unequal distribution of property. And by property, he doesn't mean land. Today, when we say property, we usually mean a couple of acres you have there in the house. Property was another word for wealth. So there were people who had wealth. Democracy, as they saw it, was dangerous, and by definition, it was excessive. Democracy was something that led to mob rule. The working poor are riffraff. The Constitution, brothers and sisters, was and is a filtered system. What does it filter? Popular sentiment, popular input, ruled by the common folks. Get a look at your Constitution. You cannot vote for the U.S. president. Nobody has ever voted for an American president. You can only vote for electors in your state. And if those electors of one party win a majority of the vote, they then cast their votes for that president. That's the way it's still working. You're not literally voting for the man. You're voting for an electoral college in your state. That was done because they wanted to filter out the passions of the people. And the people were not all crazed and impassioned and outraged about this, that, or the other thing. But they saw people who wanted to challenge us, people who said your property is too much, too fast, too dishonest, too exploitative. We won't stand for it. That's what they saw as wild mob rule and all that, meaning people who are agitating and fighting against their interests and against the injustices that have been perpetrated on them. Senators, the Constitution that they set up, nobody could elect senators. The U.S. senators were elected by the state legislators. So, again, another filter between what the people want and what was there, how it impact on the rulers. It wasn't until 1917 with an amendment to the Constitution that we now vote directly for senators, U.S. senators. The Supreme Court. Nobody has ever voted for a member of the Supreme Court. He's appointed by the president, and he serves for a lifetime. That is not democracy. That's oligarchy. That's ruled by a few who are unaccountable to anyone else. Then they got to the last part of government, which was the House of Representatives. And that's when finally a few people got up and said, James Wilson of Pennsylvania, Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania, Colonel Mason of Virginia, that was a surprise. Mason University in Virginia exists. It's named after him. They got up and they said, look, we got to leave something for the people. They got to be connected to this Constitution. If we block it all out for ourselves, it's not going to get passed and be ratified. But that fight to get direct representation from the House of Representatives really brought it out in these delegates. They started coming out and talking about the people are riffraff, the people are this, and the people are mindless, and they don't know how to rule themselves, and they need our leadership, and all that sort of stuff. As it was, this Constitution was so completely undemocratic, since it was a concoction of the rich, that it wasn't getting accepted. It wasn't being ratified by the various states. To get it ratified by the states began to ratify the Constitution with a stipulation saying, we will accept this U.S. Constitution and take it on the U.S. government as long as you add rights to the people. And that's when Madison got down there and he wrote the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which we know as what? The Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights. And that very first amendment is the people shall have the right to peaceful assemble and to have freedom of whatever they want to say in their, and their religious rights and so forth and such. Never said that we have to have religions or we institute any religion in there. Not at all. Well, enough on the Constitution. That gives you an idea that how in fact, how qualified our rights were in those days. Let me say something else about the ideology of wealth and how it protects a class system. Wealth and privilege rarely stand naked. Wealth is usually enshrouded in the legitimating myths that treat this or that social order as the natural order. Chinese landlords in feudal China, William Hinton wrote about this in his book, Fan Shen. He lived in China right in the middle of the Chinese Revolution, too. The Chinese landlords used to have a saying that they used to tell the peasants who worked and half starved themselves so that the landlord couldn't live good and well and wastefully and whatever else. And the saying was that the sun cannot rise in the west. See, the sun, you can no more rule and run things and push me aside and try to live without me. You can no more rule than can the sun rise in the west instead of coming from the east. That's what capitalism gives us today in the ideology that is promulgated. It gives us these mythologies that it fosters democracy. And I was trying to tell you that those of wealth and property and control did not push for democracy. They talked about democracy the way many of the ancient Romans did, as a dangerous thing, a mob rule, a proletarian rabble, and so forth. And where am I? Doesn't matter. I'm getting there. Okay. Two basic things to keep in mind about democracy. First, it's not a system born of a blueprint. Rather, it emerged in imperfect fits and starts from the field of political struggle, most usually class struggle. In other words, it's not a Grecian urn that comes to us from the Greeks, from Athens, and says, this is democracy, and now we will do it, and we will use it. It's a very messy struggle thing, and it's very closely related to class struggle, from the contest between those who possess wealth and property against those who do not. This said, the second consideration becomes evident. Democracy is more than a form of governance. It also has a substantive dimension. So I make a distinction between procedural democracy and substantive democracy, or to put it more bluntly, electoral democracy and economic democracy. We hear that the free market provides for us. We should try and depend on the free market, which is one of the great gifts of capitalism, we're told. Well, we did. We've done it all through most of our history. We've depended on the free market. In 1900, I say the free market, I call it 1900. Because you look back at 1900, there were no government regulations to speak of, no minimum wage, no limit on the workday. Workers were sometimes forced to work 12 hours, 14 hours, 15, 16 hours. Kids had to work. 8-9-year-old kids worked in factories in 1900. That was your free market at work. Unregulated, free to do what you want. No minimum wage. No occupational safety. No consumer protections. You used to eat meat that was diseased and rancid, and people got sick from it. Upton Sinclair documented that in his book, The Jungle. And that was well after 1900, too. No consumer protections, no public education in most communities, no hygienic regulations, no housing safety standards. So let the free market take care of that. So that was your free market. That was the democracy. The actual struggle for democracy does not go back to Franklin or James Madison or Hamilton or those people. It goes back over 2,500 years ago, long before the Philadelphia Convention. Democracy is a wonderful invention by the people of history who were seeking to defend themselves from the greed and the abuses of wealth. That's what democracy was. Time and again, it comes up as a weapon to be used against the privileges and abuses of wealth. That's what it was in Athens in the 6th century B.C., when Cleisthenes got up and ruled and had popular resistance and forces that came along with him to say, we want public control, we want public assemblies, we want to rule. The Hoplites, do you know, anybody here know who the Hoplites were? They were Athenians. They were Athenian people. They were farmers, though. And they were the guys who had enough money, I don't know how much money, whatever, they had enough property, small holders. They were small holders who could buy a shield and a broadsword and serve in the infantry, the Athenian infantry. And they put up one of the first things, with Cleisthenes going along with it. Cleisthenes was an aristocrat. He should have been on the other side with the rich guys. He was one of these aristocrats who sided with the people and was a democrat. He believed in democracy. Cleisthenes had one of his young lieutenants, one of the best guys we're fighting, was also a member of his same family, from the same aristocratic family, and he became known as the most famous democratic leader in Greek history, and his name was Pericles. We all in grad school had to read Pericles' monumental statement to the Athenian people and all that. So the Hoplites, these small farmers, said, we want to vote. We want an assembly. We want to make decisions. If we're going to have to fight these wars, we want to be able to vote on whether we can or whether we want to and whether we don't and whether it really serves our interests and whether it doesn't. And that would lead to this remarkable thing called the popular assembly, where people, we just had lots. And any week, maybe 10 of you might have drawn lots which said, you got to take 2 days in the assembly and listen to these cases and vote on them. And then there's rotation, you know. All of Athens that were not in servitude, that were free citizens, served. That was a system of democracy. That system, by the way, was really resented by Plato and Socrates. You know, you read Plato's dialogues, and he's got Socrates always talking about, look, a cobbler, a shoemaker, should make shoes. He could concentrate on that. That's his gift. Whereas the statesman, which would be one of his rich friends who was out there, the statesman shall rule the state. And everybody in their little spot, the laundry lady will do the laundry, and then this person will do that, and all that. And in other words, people should not come out of their little roles and think that they can have a say in ruling themselves. So Socrates was not somebody, I don't adore him quite as much as some of my colleagues in political science do. And there were important issues. They fought over land holdings, wages, rents, debts, taxes, food, the fear of leveling. For Plato makes the point, Socrates makes the point too, that the people who are doing these drudgy jobs should not show up the next week in the assembly. They should just keep doing these jobs. In Sparta, they all love Sparta. In Sparta, those people are helots. They're slaves. And that's the way we want. That's the way we really want it. So the next time your political philosophy teacher tells you, you don't teach political philosophy, do you, Richard? Oh, I'm sorry. There's something I want to say about this struggle for democracy and how it's against wealth, not wealth coming along, capitalism coming along, and freeing everybody to use it, is that the pursuit of economic justice is what leads to the expansion of democratic rights. U.S. workers in the 1820s and the 1830s in America waged, state by state, they waged, male workers this was, unfortunately, it was limited to white male workers, but it was a step in a direction to fight for the right to vote. Not because they particularly were interested in voting, but what they wanted was a better wage, a wage that they could live with. To get that wage, they had to pressure the bosses. To pressure the bosses, they had to form what were called combinations. But combinations, what today we call unions, but they were called combinations. Combinations, almost every judge in America declared them illegal, and out of the way. So to get the right to a combination, you needed to start electing judges. To elect judges, you had to participate in campaigns. To participate in campaigns, you had to have the right to talk. You had to have the right to speak. You'd see organizers would come out into towns and hold leaflets up and all, and the sheriff would come and others would come, and bailiffs would beat them up and throw them in jail. So the workers actually had to fight for free speech in order to organize, in order to fight politically, in order to get these material gains of a decent wage and on, and something better, a better life, a better wage, the right to organize combinations. They had to change the law. So in the pursuit of economic democracy, challenging dominant class interests, they end up expanding political democracy. The expansion of political democracy becomes a tool, a more imperfect and inadequate tool for gains, as, for instance, with the New Deal and such. So with the struggle for civil rights waged by African Americans. If you read the older African American civil rights leaders, even before Martin Luther King, you know, people like William White and others, NAACP and such, they talked about segregation, of course, and Jim Crow and the terrible oppression of it, but they also were hitting bread and butter issues like jobs, housing, protection from police abuse, protection from lynch mob rule, decent living conditions, wages and such. An end of mass incarceration, as today is a booming issue, as you know, mass incarceration, people getting arrested because a blinker on their car is broke or something, or their driver's license has expired a month ago or something. That's me, by the way. But the same with women and the right to vote and such. The right to vote among women was not merely a gender competition of, well, you men have it, so we women should have the right to vote. Women had very real injustices facing them. If a woman inherited something from her father, she gets married, her husband owns it. They couldn't own property. In one thing after another, they faced very real oppressions in work, in pay, in family, inheritance rights, education, personal safety, reproductive rights, all of which they are still fighting for. And as you can see with this new Congress here, waging war on Planned Parenthood and the like. So what we should do is notice, is observe that there's a close relationship between capitalism and democracy, an antagonistic relationship, a conflicting one. Historically, corporate capitalists have had a hard time dealing with democracy. They have opposed almost every democratic advance, the elimination of property qualifications for voting and office holding. The very super rich in America opposed eliminating that. The freedom of an independent press, they opposed that. To this day, they oppose it. The airwaves are the property of the people of the United States, yet the airwaves are licensed out to these big, rich corporations and companies, Fox and CNN and such, and they're controlled by people who have a particular view and who have the money to buy and hold all that airtime. Freedom of an independent press, the right to collective bargaining. We're still fighting, breaking unions today as ever, living wage. They opposed direct elections of office holders. They are still opposing and suppressing voters' registration, making it hard to register. You go to a working guy and say, you got to go to the county office to register before you can vote. Well, the county office is 25 miles away. It's 25 miles there, 25 back. He's just worked a long day. He probably can't even get there before it closes. So he ends up not voting. And it's a way of doing what the framers were trying to do, as you see, which is suppress and make it difficult for the ordinary people, the poor people, to qualify to vote and to participate in this system. They're proposing early voting. Early voting means instead of waiting for that one Tuesday in November, which may not be a day you could even do it, your boss wants you to work 10 hours that day, you can do an early voting earlier in the week. There'll be three early days or something that you could pick, or a whole weekend where you can go and vote. Accessible registration. The Republican Party today is against early voting. It's for fewer polling stations. It's for briefer voting hours and periods. It's calling for two hurdles, a birth certificate and a picture ID, or two picture IDs of official documents. You know, I was just thinking, do I have two official picture IDs of documents? I do, because I happen to have a passport and a driver's license. Well, there's a lot of people, poor people, elderly people, who don't have driver's license, or there are a lot of people who don't have passports. They don't get an opportunity to travel abroad. To defend their unfair privileges and exploitations, the plutocracy is ruled by the wealthy. Democracy is ruled by the demos. The demos in Greek, in the early Greek language, was the people, ruled by the people. So the plutocracy here, the plutocrats sometimes must resort to force and violence, which they do. Labor battles, breaking unions, breaking demonstrations. Consider the coordinated police repression of the Occupy movement. Do you remember, any of you remember the Occupy movement of 4 or 5 years back or so? Well, it was 1% versus 99%, and the problem was the 1%, the super rich, had the police on their side, a militarized police that went out there and systematically, in 15 major cities, made war against the occupants. Now, the plutocrats themselves today claim that they are proponents of democracy. They defend democracy. They pretend to be its progenitors, not only at home but abroad. In the last half century, the leading capitalist nations have undermined and destroyed political reformist movements and revolutions in countries throughout Latin America, Central America, Africa, Central Asia, the Middle East, and just about everywhere. In Europe, too, with the destruction of Yugoslavia, which was a social democracy, which President William Clinton bombed for 78 days and nights, and also infected with depleted uranium, so that in Serbia today, cancer is, they have the highest rate of cancer in Serbia, thanks to President Bill Clinton, who was looking after us, doing all that stuff. And they resist democratization not only at home but abroad. They resist reformist governments that pursue egalitarian economic policies, as in Libya and Syria, but they support those autocrats who pursue free market policies.
Here we must pause. We're listening to part one of Michael Parenti's recent talk, Capitalism versus Reality. For the original recording, thanks to the University of Illinois at Springfield and to Dale Lehman of station WZRD-FM in Chicago. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Find an archive of almost all our shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, question authority, and please come back for part two of Parenti's talk next week. Ciao. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm joined on the show by Mike Berger. He's the media coordinator for one of the first 9/11 Truth websites. It's called 911truth.org. One of the reasons I'm doing this show today is because I'm often asking people who are new to 9/11 Truth or resistant to it to do their own research. And it isn't always easy to know where to go to get started. The 911truth.org website is one source that is helpful for beginners and researchers. So I asked Mike Berger to join me today on the show to discuss 9/11 and the website. Mike Berger, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Cheryl.
So I understand you're the media coordinator with the website 911truth.org, which has been around for quite a long time. Maybe you could tell us how you first got interested in 9/11 and how you got involved with the website.
My interest in 9/11 grew from having grown up in New York City and having had family that lived in Lower Manhattan that day. And I, like other people who were watching the news that morning, that was how I became aware of what had happened in New York and tuned in just in time to see the second plane hit on television. And unlike a lot of other people, I did not in any sense have some immediate understanding of what I saw unfolding. I didn't even question it, frankly. It was over a year and a half before I began to question. And the only reason I began to question was when I came across people debating, people having had foreknowledge of the events, which was evident on the financial markets of the world. And having traded options and futures, I was familiar with how the financial markets worked. And so when I saw people debating this on the internet, I thought I would be able to debunk these claims pretty quickly and dismiss them. And I went to my charts for the Chicago Board of Options Exchange and looked at puts and calls, bets that were made on whether or not individual company stocks will go up or down by a specific date, which options expire the third Friday of every month. So the claims that people were making online were that it was clear that large bets were being made that implied foreknowledge because they were made specifically on the airlines that were involved, the corporations that had large numbers of floors leased in the towers, the companies that insured the towers, and the companies that insured the insurance companies that insured the towers. And when I started looking at the puts made on the airlines, I was shocked because the claims that I was reading were right there in the data and there was no way to refute them. I mean, United and American, there were substantially significant bets made that their stocks would plummet. And yet the same wasn't true for other airlines that were not involved. And historically going back, the volume was many 100% larger than it had ever been prior to the attacks with the history of those stocks. And the same pattern held for the insurance companies. And so that's what led me to begin my own questioning and my own reading. And once I started to look at some of the other claims, this was back in 2003, I couldn't stop because I could not believe that I would be able to go and read mainstream media accounts that were entirely different from what a lot of people perceived and what the general perception was of the public and what the government was telling the public. If you took the time to do a little digging on your own, it was pretty easy to come up with really solid information that contradicted most of what consensus reality was at the time about the attacks, and that truly shocked me.
Yeah, and that's what I try and tell any listeners who are new to this. Don't take my word for it, but go do your own research. It's out there. You just have to get away from CNN, Fox, and New York Times and kind of thing, and you'll see it all out there.
And you bring up another issue, again, which is the people who have dug in on the other side of this issue, who claim that it's people who question are either un-American, they're professional conspiracy theorists. Well, one of the great arguments they make is, well, gee, you know, the New York Times, don't you think the left liberal media, which they make silly statements such as that the left and the liberals control the media, which is absurd, but even if you grant them that,
right,
then the liberal media would have been all over this. And what's really fascinating about that is that actually there are significant stories by mainstream media that did point out the lies, the misleading, and yet, even like you bring up the New York Times, when the final report was issued on the collapse of Building 7, the New York Times reported verbatim the answer to a question about how come there was no testing of the physical evidence for explosive residue, and Shyam Sundar at the press conference, who was one of the lead investigators of the final report on 7, you know, is quoted in the New York Times as saying, well, you know, if there were witnesses who had seen or if explosives had been used, there would be many eyewitnesses who would have reported hearing or seeing explosions. It would be like standing in front of the speakers at a rock concert. And what I thought was fascinating was here the New York Times is quoting this verbatim. And yet, it was the New York Times that sued the city of New York that published the first responders' interviews that the city collected. And the New York Times actually had to sue the city of New York to make these accounts public. And so here's the paper that sued the city to make the accounts public, that they're now publishing a story that claims those same accounts don't exist.
Yeah, somebody's gotten to them for sure. And often when these articles come out in the mainstream media, particularly more back at the beginning, that supported the people who challenged the official story, they only aired them once. They never get picked up again. They kind of go into the memory hole and nobody references them again.
Yeah, very, very true.
Back to the website, that's an interesting history on how you got started. So it was the financial questions and inconsistencies that drew you in. Now, when did you join the 911truth.org website? And maybe you could give us a little history about how the website got started.
Sure. 911truth.org was, I believe, the person to credit with actually putting this together would be David Kubiak. He was the original executive director. And in 2004, the San Francisco group had put together the first international 9/11 conference, which I attended, and it was the first time that basically people who had been writing and publishing, academics, researchers, people who had taken it on themselves to begin looking into this, actually met for the first time anywhere in the world, in the U.S., I should say. It was in San Francisco in 2004, and I think from the confluence of people at that conference, David Kubiak pulled together various allies to create 911truth.org. So it was initially formed and kind of coalesced in 2004. So it's now going, sad enough to say, it's in its 11th year.
And I know when it first started, and for quite a few years there, it was like the place to go for information about 9/11. I think that may have changed somewhat now, but and when did you get involved with the website?
I became affiliated in the end of roughly 2005 and kind of not really in any kind of official capacity till it was right at the time when Charlie Sheen made his first public comments about questioning what he saw on the Alex Jones show. And it had turned out just a few weeks before that. So that was in the spring of 2006. So really in the spring of 2006 is right literally 2 weeks before Charlie Sheen appeared on Alex Jones, I had agreed to do media for 9/11 Truth. 2 weeks later, I was on national television.
Wow.
It was pretty crazy. And actually, it was probably to this day one of the most fair airings of 9/11 Truth news. Now, unfortunately, of course, the mainstream news didn't cover it. It was Showbiz Tonight covered it. And actually, Showbiz Tonight started inviting multiple people from the movement onto the show. That first night, I got to speak to the producer before the show aired, and just kind of, we had a 15-minute conversation of going back and forth over what I thought were some of the really, really important things to make public. And the producer told me, he said, you know, how come I don't know any of this? And I thought that was kind of interesting. And so believe it or not, yeah, it was Showbiz Tonight that actually opened up this can of worms. And then very quickly, other people from the movement were invited on, and by the next day, they had pretty much already pushed that producer out of the show.
Wow. That's how that works. Yeah. It really is a taboo subject. But tell me, what kind of traffic has the website had over the years?
Well, I mean, going back, there was a period, I would say, from the inception in 2004 until we did our Chicago conference in the summer of 2006. Where 911truth.org was one of the large 911 Truth portals. And so we had some incredibly high number of unique visitors and views for years. And to me, 2006 was kind of a major shift in the 911 Truth movement, partly as a result of we, 911truth.org, had a conference in Chicago, which actually was covered. The New York Times actually sent a reporter to our conference, who actually stayed with us for the entire duration of the conference, which was a weekend-long conference.
I didn't know that.
There were hundreds of people from all over the country who came to Chicago to go to this conference, and many of them left Chicago kind of energized and interconnected. And again, it's hard for people to imagine this now, but this was before there was social media. So the web was what was enabling people to communicate and meet each other prior to there being the social media. But there was nothing like this, considering the net was still in its relative infancy. And coming out of Chicago, literally hundreds of grassroots local groups formed around the country and spawned tens of thousands of 9/11 sites. So there was this kind of enormous expansion of the number of people who became 9/11 advocates. By 2006, I'd say that was, in one sense, the high watermark of the number of people truly active, thinking that they could get an investigation.
That's interesting, because I think that's when Richard Gage started in 2006. He said he heard David Ray Griffin speaking, and that's when he got involved, and then he created his website, The Architects and Engineers. So that does seem to be a pivotal year for the movement.
Yeah, we had hit a critical number of people, I think, at that point, who had at least become aware that the story they were told was a lie.
Yeah. Now, you said the New York Times had a reporter there. Did they report on the event?
Yes, they did. They wrote a rather long article.
Oh.
I mean, not all necessarily incredibly friendly, but again, we did get a rather sizable article in the New York Times about the conference.
Wow, that's astounding. So the website 911truth.org had a lot of traffic. I mean, it was the place to go back then. So the traffic has tapered off a little bit the farther we get away from the date of 9/11?
Oh, I think it tapered off significantly for a variety of reasons. One is just the profusion of 9/11 sites. If you search 9/11 now, you get millions of results. Well,
right.
A decade ago, that was not the case. There's certainly, and there was a different atmosphere as well. There were always sites and people making claims that, to put generously, probably didn't have any basis in reality. But a decade later now, I would say new people trying to understand what happened would have a very difficult time doing that now because of just the vast amount of information and disinformation.
Right, not knowing where to start. Right. They don't
and it's challenging to sort through and make any sense of it because supposed leaders or leading thinkers that some people will come across don't necessarily all agree on the facts. And so I think one of the failures as a movement that we've, looking back with the hindsight of, you know, a decade of involvement, is we really failed to kind of come to a core agreement on basic facts to promote everywhere at once. And so now I think it's very difficult, I think, for people to make sense of what's out there. I just read an article a couple of weeks ago that was pointing out that 25% of the country was either too young or not born when it happened. So they don't know anything. They
right.
didn't live through it, and it's kind of, for them, it's forgotten. It's an unknown.
Yeah, it's sort of like when I was a kid hearing about World War II or something. It was before
right.
I was born, you know. Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
So unless you had an interest in history, you weren't going to learn about World War II beyond what maybe you were taught in school. And we don't even want to get into how 9/11 is taught now.
Right. No, that's a disaster. We know. And I think also, as you mentioned, there's so many websites and there's so many, you know, people disagree on different aspects of 9/11. And so that's all out there. And then you have all the disinformation sites and people putting out false information. And so it is very difficult. And that's why your site can be a good site for beginners, particularly to get some of the basics down and then expand from there. What sort of information could a newcomer find on your site that might help them get started?
Well, I think not just 911truth.org, but I would also recommend the 9/11 timeline from historycommons.org, which originally was published as a book by Paul Thompson called The Terror Timeline. The Terror Timeline, which is online as the 9/11 timeline, is basically a mainstream media accumulation of articles based on time. On the timeline of events.
Yeah, that is an incredible project and website.
Yes, and it's an amazing resource. And at 911truth.org, what we have done, in addition to original content that we were publishing a decade or so ago, is also some of the leading thinkers in the movement, mainstream media articles that cover almost every aspect of 9/11, from, let's say, the psychology of why people don't want to look at it, or don't want to acknowledge that we really don't know the truth about this event that we now know has entirely reshaped the modern world that we live in. But you can dial into whatever level of specificity on a particular topic or let's call them a participant in the event. So, I mean, one of the things that I've worked hard to try to do is to make it a research tool where anybody should be able to find what they're looking for. If they're looking for something specific, so you can search by tags, and you can actually, for example, go to the website and you click on a particular tag or topic, you're actually able to navigate through that topic chronologically by going next or prior. You can also read the website chronologically and reverse chronologically. You can read it the way the articles came out. So, I mean, I've done a lot of work on that kind of accessibility and different ways for people to access information so you can kind of get to whatever it is you're looking for.
Yeah, that's really great. I know on the site you have a tab at the top for newcomers or beginners, and it walks them through the basic information about 9/11. So I would encourage people to check that out. Again, it's 911truth.org. You have some polls that I think the 911truth.org website group was responsible for, Zogby polls. There was one in 2004, 2006, and 2007. Do you see doing a current one, or is that something that's not on the radar?
You mean in terms of doing a new poll?
Yeah.
No, that's not likely to happen. I mean, we did the first poll of New York City, which at the time, the poll concluded that there were a majority of New York City residents who questioned the government's account and called for a new investigation. We also did the first national Zogby poll as well. Yeah, 9/11 Truth was at the forefront of kind of polling and trying to get the national mood as it relates to the topic of 9/11. But I mean, at this point, we are trying to maintain this as a historic archive for researchers and people who want to learn about this, where you can go to one place and explore all different aspects of the story from different people who've provided content, whether it's mainstream media, academic researchers, 9/11 researchers, but anything that relates to the subject of 9/11. And so now, really, you know, at one point early on in the beginning, I would say even after our conference in 06, 911truth.org functioned as a portal for grassroots people to find each other locally across the country. And it was a an activist portal. We were involved in bird-dogging campaigns of political candidates to try to get them on the record about 9/11 truth. Now, more than anything, it's really a place for people who want information about 9/11 from people who are there to try to tell you to the best of their ability what the evidence is for why we question the government story.
And it's a great resource for that. So you maintain the site, and do you have any future plans for it, or more of what you just said, making it an archive for people to do research?
Yeah, I mean, I think other than maintaining the integrity of what is there, I do add to it as I find really compelling articles. But other than that, I don't see us doing anything further with it than that. Frankly, at this point, because as I've kind of alluded to before, I'm not of the opinion that there's ever going to be a real investigation, not that there's ever going to be a party that would have the authority and integrity to actually investigate it. You get to a point where you do need to acknowledge the wider reality in which we live. And I think that, more than anything, 9/11 truth for anybody who has the courage to look at the evidence, it points to a much broader, longer history of a nation that's ruled by a group other than who we were all raised to believe runs it.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to interview you, is because I'm often telling people, if you don't know anything about 9/11, it's your duty really as a citizen to learn about it and what really happened, because it does lead you down the rabbit hole, so to speak, where you learn what's really going on. And we have all these wars, the 9/11 wars in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Libya, all of those on the global war on terror is all really justified by 9/11, and the American people have been totally deceived about that. So it is really important for people even today to learn what happened and to know what's going on.
Well, I think even more important, that this is a perfect example, is that if you do not know your history and you don't know anything about this, then somebody like a Donald Trump can make absurd, false statements that mainstream media parrots. And while there has been very, very little pushback on his comments about seeing thousands of Muslims cheer from the Jersey side of the river, what you've not heard a single mainstream media outlet do is to point out the story of urban moving systems and the dancing Israelis who were set up to film and
right,
were celebrating it and who were arrested. And the FBI sent them back to Israel. Nobody was ever charged. So it's interesting because to this day, the events of 9/11 have a direct effect on the world we live in. And yet so many Americans are still blind to the reality that you learn if you start studying this event, that our civil liberties, our foreign policy, our domestic spending priorities, everything has been shifted by this event, by this one event, into which a real investigation has never been made. And so if you don't understand 9/11, you can't possibly understand what has happened to this country and how far the country has moved politically off the scale to the right.
I don't even know if I would call it to the right, but to the deep state, what you said earlier about people not knowing who's really running things.
Absolutely.
You know, and
absolutely.
And,
but to me, the deep state is this kind of reactionary fascist behind-the-scenes lever pullers.
Right, and you're going to get the same thing whether you elect a Republican or a Democrat. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. I mean, we live in a nation that's run by a corporate oligarchy. These are the people who are making the decisions behind the scenes. You can't have followed Occupy or the protests during the 2004 election when Americans who were protesting the Bush administration were locked up in cages in Boston. You know, the disbelief in the Constitution. So in other words, one of the things you would have learned if you had been reading 9/11 Truth, one of the things that we covered is writings about the deep state. We published Peter Dale Scott's material. Also work on COG. Again, many Americans don't know about continuity of government and how not only did 9/11 trigger that, but it was renewed multiple times afterwards. In other words, there was no functioning constitutional government.
I believe that that's still in place. Obama has reinstated it every year. In last 1 year, he did it.
Well, I was going to say, you can't find anywhere publicly where it has either been allowed to lapse or it has been renewed under Obama. You can trace it to where it was renewed under Bush. But as far as I've been able to tell, unless you can find it or have found it.
There was 1 year in the Obama administration, I remember reading that he did it. I think it was New Year's Eve that he renewed it, and nobody knew about it because, of course, he did it when everyone was out partying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, like, these are the kinds of topics that, for people who are open to learning about facts, the real history, that as you look, it may not be what you would like to see, but that still doesn't change that it's a fact.
Right. And as you said, if you don't get this, if you don't know this, you don't know what's going on in the world. I mean, you are operating under total misinformation. I mean, you just don't know.
You're, in effect, living a collective delusion.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, like, for example, the fear and paranoia now about Muslim immigration, the reality check to any of this is far more Americans are killed in their bathtubs, in their cars, or by random gun violence.
Right.
Than all the attempted terrorist attacks on American soil since 1970. And it's just this absurd.
Right. Not to mention that a lot of the domestic terrorist attacks have been orchestrated by the FBI. So, I mean, that's been documented.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
that the FBI informants have been forced into forming cells who were then arrested, who didn't even have the wherewithal to pull off the attacks they were accused of.
Right, many of them mentally unsound, et cetera. Mike, we're almost out of time. Is there anything you want to say to the listeners before we stop today?
To me, I think one of the most important points now in terms of where we are as a nation, I think speak to your friends and relatives who are receptive to factual information. So educating yourself to the best of your ability about what the facts are, not trying to spread theory and rumor. That the bottom line is, we have so much that is now on the public record that is demonstrably false that the government has claimed. Look, for example, I just published an article recently that showed that the Bush administration knew very, very specific information much earlier than they've ever let on before, and that this has come out in the public, even in mainstream media, and yet people act as if they didn't know, they couldn't have done anything to prevent it. You know, this was published by Politico last month, that basically everybody who has looked into this has heard of the August PDB, but what people don't know is that by May of 2001, Kofor Black was saying, quote, it was very evident that we were going to be struck. We were going to be struck hard, and lots of Americans were going to die. George Tenet said there were real plots. Now, for many people, that would be a newsflash that they had very specific info that early on, which then any rational person should lead them to question, how come nobody did anything?
Right.
And why have so many people defended that administration's lack of action on any front when they had specific actionable intel, which mainstream media pundits always point out they didn't have. But we now have over a decade plus of research that demonstrates the exact opposite. They knew names, they knew targets, they knew where they were while they were in the country. They let them into the country. These people didn't sneak in. They came in and had driver's licenses and addresses and phone lines and their actual names. They were not placed on watch lists. I mean,
right.
The more you look at it, the more absurd the story gets. You have to deal with this really kind of strange, warped sense of reality. By looking at the information, you've also got to be prepared to kind of become an outsider. Because you're going to see the world differently than the people who just go along day by day accepting what they're being told is happening around them and why.
Right. You're going to feel like you live in a parallel universe to normal everyday stuff. Yeah.
And that's challenging.
It is. And that's why it's really important to have a group to be associated with who thinks the way you do and has done the research. That's really important to have that support.
It helps.
Yeah, it helps. It And now that we're in the middle of the holiday season and getting together for dinners and parties with family and friends, If you already haven't had that special outsider feeling because of your 9/11 truth-based worldviews, just bring them up at one of these dinners or parties, and I'm sure you'll see what we're talking about. Mike, so thank you again for being on the show. I'm sorry we're out of time, but let's do this again soon. And thank you for sharing your knowledge.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Cheryl. It's been my pleasure.
And again, you've just been listening to an interview with Mike Berger, media coordinator for the website 911truth.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. November 24th, the Chicago Police Department released a long-awaited dash cam video from the shooting death of Laquan McDonald in Chicago. Craig Futterman, clinical professor of law and director of the Civil Rights and Police Accountability Project, was instrumental in that release through his successful FOIA request. Professor Futterman and the Invisible Institute recently released the Citizens Police Data Project, which provides a powerful tool to research several years of complaints against Chicago police officers. Now, Professor Futterman talks with us about the alarming numbers on race and police misconduct in Chicago and the context for the most recent police killings of the 55-year-old mother of five, Betty Jones, and her young upstairs neighbor, 19-year-old Quintano LaGuerre. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start from something positive. The work that you are doing that engenders the questions of accountability, transparency, and the systemic reality of police abuse, particularly of a racial nature. So begin by telling us about the project you're involved in.
Sure. Until the housing projects were torn down in Chicago and entire communities were disappeared, my law students and I worked for about 7 years from the ground floor of what was called Stateway Gardens, a public housing development on Chicago's South Side. It became a second home to us, a home base from the law school where we work. Our primary work there was working with residents in public housing, documenting human rights conditions, reporting on them, working with residents to try to improve police service and accountability in their community. State Street Corridor, that's where we were working, where Stateway sat, made up at that time the largest concentration of public housing in the nation, largest concentration of poverty in the nation, about a four-mile stretch of 10 and 17-story high-rise apartments filled with thousands of our nation's poorest families. Everybody who lived there was black. For context, then, during that time, we got to know a woman by the name of Diane, a 50-year-old public school janitor, single parent who lived there. We mostly knew her just as a friendly face who always seemed to have a kind word and honestly some delicious food for her neighbors. Mm. And then we just stopped seeing her. Nowhere to be found. Turns out that over the course of about a year, a team of five tactical police officers subjected Diane to a series of repeated assaults on her person, her home, family, religion, and this group, who were widely known as the Skullcap Crew, forced her on a couple of occasions to disrobe, bare the most private parts of her body, threaten her with a loaded gun, needle-nose pliers, screwdriver, leaving her convinced they were going to rape or kill her, beat and choked her. They assaulted her with racist, sexist epithets of the worst kind, tore up her home. They threatened to plant drugs on her. They even brought a middle-aged neighbor into her home, and she had a teenage son, and they forced her teenage son to beat the older black man for their amusement, like a staged cockfight. So this is the context in which we were working. Then my students and I learned that these five officers had engaged in a years-long pattern of abusing black folk in public housing, Southside Chicago. We heard multiple firsthand reports of what they were doing, including their sadistic sexual abuse of her. What distinguished these guys more than anything else was their overt racism and the particular pleasure that they seemed to take in these acts. Most of all, they knew with absolute certainty that they could abuse black folk in public housing without fear of consequence. Nothing would happen to them. That was the context in which we got into this, because our work really started and this project was designed to be a project that would be community-based, on the ground, directed by people in the community, as opposed to a project where we, and I'm a law professor too, so in my ivory tower, where I'm just picking out, here's something I think is important, and let's go find people who could help us raise an issue. So the work that we did around transparency and accountability, and even the work that ultimately led to the release and the uncovering, the ending of the secrecy of the video of the execution of Laquan McDonald, started right there in 8 square blocks of Chicago's South Side. Then we wound up bringing a civil rights lawsuit with Diane and her neighbors to not just challenge, and my students tend to ask not just questions about what occurred, but how and why it occurred. Why were five officers who worked in public housing, what were the conditions, the underlying conditions that allowed them to believe that they could abuse black people here with absolute impunity? And so as a part of our investigation, as a part of our lawsuit, we obtained about 6 years of data from the city about every single complaint that involved police brutality or other serious abuse. When we analyzed that data, we saw exactly why the Skullcap crew thought that they could operate with impunity. Our police department here, and this is not unique to Chicago, but they refused to examine patterns of abuse in black and brown communities, that the probability that the members of the Skullcap crew would be disciplined when charged with abuse, nearly zero. Fellow officers would cover for them every time when abusing black folks, and that the department's practices, because we actually also got to look at all these investigative files, hundreds of files, that the department's practices for investigating misconduct were designed to ensure that officers like them would be absolutely immune from discipline. We got to see this under what's called a court protective order, meaning a secret order that nobody else can see this but us and for the purposes of litigation. This is critically important information that was hidden from the public. Why all these things were going on in Chicago, and why these things, secrecy and institutional denial, why these things are going on around urban America. That's what led to us ultimately bringing, in addition to this lawsuit where we uncover this information, but we're not allowed to share it as we're fighting for justice for Diane, but we also then bring a Freedom of Information Act case, and it's something that nobody was bringing. There was all this major media, and nobody stepped up to bring anything like this. But an independent journalist worked with us and tried to intervene in this case, and he brought a Freedom of Information Act suit to try to uncover this stuff, to establish the principle that, hey, this is critically important information that belongs to the people. It took about 5 years and a five-year fight, but we were ultimately successful in establishing that precedent first in Illinois. And the database that you just talked about, because over the next year, this happened about a year ago when we won that case. But to bring this home, we're in the process and we just built a database that tries to give everybody that resides in the community, ordinary people, researchers, scholars, journalists, policymakers, police organizers, advocates, everybody, with access to information about every single police misconduct complaint in Chicago. And if we're ultimately successful, this is what we're going to have, because nothing like this exists in the nation. We're going to have information on every single complaint in Chicago from 1967 to the present. Every complaint available to every single person. That is, to me, the core of the beginning of how we begin to address these problems. It's a fundamental redistribution of power from police to ordinary people. And to me, any conversation about solutions, much less trying to build positive relationships or trust between black and brown communities and police, has to begin with some honesty, and that's acknowledging the reality of experience of folks in some of our country's most marginalized communities. That's the work that we're trying to do.
So you begin to quantify and have this significant data, which should lead to both transparency at some point and accountability. It certainly has led to some individual litigation. The video release, for example, of Laquan McDonald, the terrifying, searing into one's soul, execution of this young man. What further do you think is accomplished that can begin to strike at the institutionalized basis of police violence in Chicago and the racialized nature of police violence?
Transparency, honesty is the first step. And it's only the first step because opening up police departments to the people, that doesn't automatically eliminate racism or sexism within them. It doesn't end the code of silence. It doesn't guarantee that we're going to have fair, thorough, or high-quality investigations into police misconduct. And it certainly doesn't put an end to patterns of police abuse. But what it does do is it creates the conditions to accomplish each and every one of those things if we all act and if we make use of this information. And I think that's where there lies real hope that this is something that can be a real transformative moment. When we redistribute that fundamental power from the police to the people, that's what creates conditions for accountability. That's what creates conditions for addressing and diagnosing accurately, just like my medical friends tell me. I mean, if you don't have an accurate diagnosis, you're not going to get an accurate, you're not going to have an effective cure. And diagnosis here are issues of absence of police accountability, racism, and institutional denial. This is the very kind of information, as well as critically important. I mean, these are just data that documents the real and lived experiences of people who are at the ground. And it also means truly engaging, listening to, and the effective activism of folks at the ground, like folks in the Black Lives Matter movement, who've really begun to force broader society to reckon with those realities and challenge people to care about the lives of all Black folks.
Sharon Farley, who's head of the Independent Police Review Authority, she's the new head. The older head had been dismissed because of his incompetence and the cover-up of the death of Laquan McDonald. She called for some new procedures in that authority. And I know that you're also calling for a new police auditor's office. What do you think should be done with regard to review of the conduct of the police in these matters?
There's a multi-pronged piece, and it starts with honesty. It starts with, hey, when an incident of charged abuse goes down, if you want any hope of trust, you got to start with some honesty. If you lie to people, if you deny what happens, if you cover it up, no one's ever going to trust you. So it starts with when something goes down, you got to be transparent about it. And that means tell people the truth. It means that there is something like a video that there's no reason why, and particularly a video that occurs in a public area, there's no reason why that shouldn't be released within 24 to 48 hours. It starts with that, but then it ends with a system of accountability. And that means addressing things like the police code of silence, starting with some honesty again. You got to acknowledge that it exists in New York as well. I mean, there's a code of silence about the code of silence. What's that, a Hollywood movie? When that is one of the most inimical things to any accountability that hurts the people and honestly hurts the police, good, honest, and ethical officers as well, by giving them a bad name when officers are allowed to abuse the most vulnerable among us with impunity. You know, there's the age-old question of who polices the police, and certainly we all do. The role and being and for the public to play that role and to play it in a meaningful way, it means we got to be informed and we have to act. There's no one right solution, and around the country, we have different ways in which the public's involved, from in the role of monitor to civilian review to almost like an appellate court. There's no one right way. I'm a fan more of giving civilians the real power to do these investigations independent from the police and in ways in which they're fully empowered to do and fully funded to do those investigations so that it's not just, you know, the reality, unfortunately, is also around the nation. That includes in New York with CCRB, is that the history of these organizations have been largely ineffective. So the way in which we make them much more effective is, one, we establish them in ways and create independence. Two, we give them the resources and the power that they need to do their jobs and to do their work. Three, we ensure that they're looking at things like patterns of abuse, patterns of misconduct, not turning a blind eye to that. for dealing with collective bargaining agreements that stand in the way of doing effective, high-quality investigations. And then four, when you find that officers have done wrong, you don't hesitate to do what you're supposed to do. When you weed out those officers who are abusive and you send a message to the good officers that that's not what we are about. We're not about doing this. Those, to me, are the first steps. And then, of course, there's a lot more, and it means training. It means a change of mindset among officers. It means addressing the realities of racism, both conscious and unconscious, that exists both in society and certainly on police forces, as well as police officers are a part of all of who we are. And it means taking those things on head on.
Police Officer Van Dyke, yep, who will be the first police officer who's been charged in an on-duty shooting in Chicago. But he had 20 misconduct complaints which were made against him in the past 4.5 years. None led to disciplinary action against the Chicago Police Department. How do you see that reality in the context of what you are doing now so admirably, which is the accumulation of data and the release of the information that you accomplish?
Knowledge is power. So imagine if first all the people, as we do now, had access to this information. And then something that exists in Chicago, and this is not unique to Chicago, but this is around the nation. As around the nation, most urban police departments have a policy and practice where they refuse to look at patterns of complaints as a part of investigating misconduct or disciplining misconduct. And that's just indefensible. If we looked at patterns, and just as you said, so just taking Van Dyke as one example, within just a few years before him shooting and killing Laquan, 17-year-old child, he had 20 complaints, most of them for brutality, almost all of them against black folks. He had been involved in two other shootings just within a couple of years of shooting this kid. He had been not just sued once, sued twice, and not just even sued, but found guilty of brutality by a federal jury, costing the city, I think, $500,000. It shouldn't have taken 20 complaints and that pattern before we had done something about him. And so if the people had this information, that's where it's our job to act and say, city, as a matter of policy, if we can see this, certainly so can you. It's more long past time that you use this knowledge to weed out those racist officers, abusive officers among us that also give honorable officers a bad name and do so much harm to the entire community.
How might you look at Rahm Emanuel and his duty, his responsibility, or the omission, the negligence in responding to a history of police abuse in the Chicago Police Department, indeed, with a terrifying, sordid history of torture, as well as these shootings? What do you think his responsibility should be? Should part of the issue of the rectification be now to call for him to step down?
Mayor Emanuel did not create this stuff. He did not create the code of silence, racism in the police department. He was not the one who was responsible for implementing a pattern and practice of police torture, which very well did exist. And we still have prisoners in Illinois who have been tortured and who are still fighting for their freedom. But upon inheriting it, it was and is his responsibility to address it. And that's an area in which, up to this point, he has fallen. And he now admits that he has fallen far short of doing what needs to be done. On the positive side, I was saying he was a part of creating an historic reparations ordinance for victims of police torture that acknowledge, and again, step one is acknowledging this history of torture in Chicago. And indeed, it is now part of our law that we are teaching it to public school students in our classrooms as a part of history. Where he's fallen short has been not just about acknowledging history, because it's one thing to say that was then, but this is now. We don't have these issues anymore. And until just a few weeks ago, he was a part of the problem of denial. He took a step in the right direction when he negotiated with us around this policy of new openness of the police department, making that policy a reality after we fought and won that litigation. He did work with us, and that was a major step in the right direction. But it's now really incumbent upon him, and it's incumbent upon all of us. So whether it be calling for, some are calling for his resignation, and others are also calling just for him to do what he's supposed to do, to hold him accountable. He has now owned these issues finally. I think that creates a contract with the people, as long as he is in office, that he is also publicly accountable for these conditions and for addressing them. We've begun to take some steps in that direction, but it's more than just crisis management. It's, to quote Mayor Emanuel to himself, who said as an aide to President Obama, never let a good crisis go to waste. But the more important part of the quote is because it creates the opportunities for leaders to do what they otherwise could not do. He has an historic opportunity, and the question is how he is going to go down, what his legacy will be. So he has a chance, and I think it's incumbent upon all of us to hold him accountable for his obligations and responsibility to address these issues, which he is responsible for.
How has he been handling, in your view, the recent police killings of Quintanio Liguerre and Biddy Jones?
Well, I'm an outsider here, and this is also just going down. And one thing that I'd say that has been a marked change from what I've ever seen, and in Chicago, these shootings occur and have occurred for the last 30 years on an average of a weekly basis. And that's something that goes back about 30 years. Something that also hasn't changed over 30 years is that 75% of the people shot by police are African American. It has been more than 50 years, or actually never, when in terms of an African American, never in history am I aware of a single instance up until just now in which a Chicago police officer was criminally prosecuted for an on-duty shooting of a black man, woman, or child. So in terms of one thing that I've seen different now, and it is a marked change, was that almost immediately after the shooting, there was an admission that part of the shooting, at least, was an accident. I've never heard that kind of admission before, that they did not intend to shoot. This is the neighbor. But since then, and still not a lot of time has passed, and this goes to my point about step one is being transparent and telling the truth throughout the process. It's keeping people informed and releasing information to the public. As long as it's not going to compromise the integrity of the investigation, they should be sharing a lot more, because that's how you're going to earn and that's how you're ultimately going to win any kind of a trust. As far as the incident itself, I wasn't there, but I'm an outside observer, and it seems horrible and tragic. An incident that starts with a young man emotionally disturbed with a baseball bat should not end in the taking of his life or the life of a neighbor. But there's a lot more to be learned and seen with that, and I think the responsibility is to be upfront and transparent about what's there and what happened.
How do you begin to understand the systemic roots deep in the history of our country, our policing apparatuses that formed for control of the African-American communities, whether or not it's a conscious bias, grievous, outrageous bigotry, or so rooted in the psyche and social fabric of this country? What do you see as the roots of these prevalent abuses and taking of black life within Chicago that further need to be addressed?
Well, it starts with one word, and that's racism. The history of policing in this country was founded on slave patrol, viewing black folks as property. There's a long legacy that then has move forward, and there is a long and sordid history of racialized policing in America that's not just a relic of the past, that continues today. So it's addressing and being honest, not just about the history, but about present-day realities of what can sometimes feel like a system of apartheid justice. Going back to public housing and also work that we're presently doing with high school students in the south and west sides of Chicago, predominantly African-American neighborhoods. And my students mostly come from relatively privileged backgrounds, University of Chicago Law School, and they're taught in their law school classrooms about the Constitution. And then they go and they spend time and see a very different reality in black and brown communities in Chicago, where this constitution that they learn about and that has been consistent with most of their own experience in their lifetime doesn't seem to apply in places where we've worked, in places where all, where so many folks live, that the reality of just you're young, you're black, you're on the street, you live with the ever-present reality of the possibility of being stopped, searched, treated like a criminal, and that's normal, both from a community perspective and it's treated as normal from a policing perspective. And it is shocking to my students who come from a different reality, like, whoa, that would never be countenanced in the communities in which they live. And what that means in the Constitution, to stop or to search someone, so I'll say as a law professor, what that means is that you have to have reasonable suspicion that that person has committed a crime. And if you're going to search them, you're saying that you have reasonable belief that they are armed and dangerous. So every single child is getting a message here, black in Chicago, New York, L.A., that we look like armed and dangerous criminals. And that mindset needs to be fundamentally changed so that police officers see themselves not as outsiders, but as a part of the community, accountable to the community, beholden to the community, and guardians. And I talk with many folks in the neighborhoods, if they're choosing between, in their experience, what they have, and many, many folks will say, we want no police because they're not doing any good for us. And I don't think that's fair either. When you have folks who don't have a, it's the paradox of too much and too little at the same time, of we hear story after story of police not being there responding appropriately when needed, and then the story of too much when they're abusive and treating people disrespectfully. Why not give people in public housing communities and other black and brown communities around the same thing that many folks in white middle-class communities get, want, and ask, which are basically police who are going to be respectful of the basic dignity of every person, and police officers who are a part of and who are there and who are supposed to be there to provide protection and to be a guardian. So it really requires a change of mindset. And positively, I've seen some of those things happen in other places. I used to live in the Bay Area in California. I used to live for a short time in Oakland and neighboring city, Richmond, California. And when I was there, Richmond's predominantly minority community, predominantly low income. There was a terrible relationship between police and community. And I saw what a change of mindset could do there. There was a new police chief who came in, and his name is Chris Magnus, who has done some incredible things in terms of trying to change the mindset of the officers there. It's paid dividends. He's created real accountability, and we're seeing not just crime at all-time lows in Richmond, California, but police shootings at all-time lows and uses of force at all-time lows. And because officers are now seeing themselves and being evaluated by resolving conflict, resolving situations without the need for arrest, that's how they get points, by getting out of their cars and engaging folks in positive relationships, by being involved and working in neighborhoods for sustained amounts of time, being accountable to folks in that community, building trust. That's how they get credit. And it's a change of mindset, and it can make a difference.
Well, we want to thank you for sharing your thoughts with us, and most strategically, some of the work that you have been doing, the very important work which we can look to in our cities, such as New Jersey, Connecticut, and New York. How can people find out more about your actual project?
I'm easy to find on the University of Chicago Law School's website, and there is a webpage that you can click on for me and my project and see what we're up to. And that's where I go. If you simply Google my name, University of Chicago, really easy to find.
Well, Professor Craig Futterman, clinical professor of law and director of the Civil Rights and Police Accountability Project, and who's done this important critical study, Citizens Police Data Project, talking about accountability, transparency, and putting control in the hands of the community for the vile and abusive processes that have ensued, lo, these many years in Chicago amongst the policing apparatus. We thank you so much for joining us, and, of course, keep up the good work, and we'll learn from it.
I'm so grateful for you having me. Thanks so much.
Our pleasure.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Every month I get a report on who's watching, from what country. It's never a surprise to know that the United States is number one, and Canada and Mexico. But sometimes it's like Pakistan or Saudi Arabia. We know we are reaching a much broader audience. And in some ways, we know that audience. It's where the United States was 30 years ago. And it really feels very comfortable for us to be supporting those people in their struggles.
Happy New Year and welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. India's same-gender-loving citizens stay outlaws, Malawi gays escape jail sentences, but their peers in Tunisia and Senegal are not so lucky, and a film critic reviews the serendipitous success of Wolf Video. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the 3 weeks ending January 2nd, 2016. Gays and lesbians remain outlaws in the second most populous country in the world as this new year begins. Lawmakers in India have rejected the latest attempt to repeal the British colonial-era Crimes Against Nature statute known as Penal Code Section 377. The country's Supreme Court infamously upheld Section 377 in 2013, ruling that only Parliament could overturn it. After the rejection on December 18th of his private member's bill to revise Section 377, MP Shashi Tharoor of the opposition National Congress Party said that it was surprising to see such intolerance. His proposal would have changed Section 377 to outlaw only non-consensual, underage, or coerced sex. There is no debate after the lopsided vote of 71 to 24 opposed the bill's formal introduction on the floor. That conveniently meant that none of the MPs had to go on the record in a possible vote for either decriminalization or maintaining the status quo. Saying that he was not giving up, Tharoor launched a change.org petition as 2015 ended, asking supporters to demonstrate to the government that Indian citizens favor repeal. Section 377 is a British relic, drafted in 1860 and based on outdated Victorian morals, he wrote. It has no place in a modern nation like India. The petition reportedly drew more than 20,000 signatures in its first day online.
Greece's parliament overwhelmingly approved a civil partnership bill for same-gender couples on December 22nd. The vote of 194 to 55 came 2 years after the European Court of Human Rights condemned the country for discriminating against lesbian and gay couples. Civil partnerships have been an alternative to civil marriage for heterosexual couples in Greece since 2009. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras of the ruling left-wing Syriza party issued an unprecedented apology to the LGBT community in a speech to Parliament the day after the bill's passage, saying that a cycle of backwardness and shame for the Greek state is closing.
But on December 20th, voters in Slovenia rejected an amendment to the country's Marriage and Family Relations Act to open the civil institution to same-gender couples. The gender-neutral marriage proposal was approved by Slovenia's parliament in March. But opponents gathered the 40,000 required signatures on a petition to hold a referendum on the issue. Lawmakers, led by the ruling coalition government, then voted to reject such a referendum because popular votes on human rights issues had been constitutionally prohibited since 2013. But the Southern Central European country's constitutional court disagreed in October, setting the stage for the December referendum. 37% of those who cast their votes were in favor of marriage equality, but 63% voted against it. About a third of the 1.7 million registered voters cast ballots. Mia Lobnik of the marriage equality group It's Time for Yes told the New York Times that we are not giving up.
In other same-gender couple news, a gay man in South Central China has filed suit against a local government agency demanding civil marriage equality. 26-year-old Sun Wenlin filed the complaint against the Furong District Civil Affairs Bureau in Hunan's provincial capital of Changsha in mid-December, challenging the bureau's refusal to allow him and his male partner to register their marriage. Sun's lawyer is arguing that current Chinese marriage law refers to the union of husband and wife, but doesn't specify the gender of either party.
A gay civil servant in Hong Kong is suing the government for refusing to recognize his marriage to another man. Angus Leung Chung Kwong, who's worked at the Immigration Department since 2002, married his partner of 10 years in New Zealand last year. However, Hong Kong government agencies have repeatedly refused to recognize his marriage and extend medical benefits to his husband, citing the city's marriage ordinance that defines it as the voluntary union for life of one man and one woman. Leung is arguing that the refusal to recognize his legal civil marriage violates the Hong Kong Bill of Rights, sex discrimination ordinance, and the government's own anti-discrimination policies.
The Vienna Administrative Court has dismissed several civil marriage equality cases, including a novel lawsuit filed by the children of same-gender couples. Proponents say they'll appeal to Austria's Federal Administrative Court. The country's leading and oldest LGBT advocacy group, Hossi Vienne, actually opposes those lawsuits at this time because they say the country's antiquated marriage and divorce laws need to be modernized first. The group's Secretary General, Kurt Krickler, told gay journalist Rex Wagner that Hossi Vienne is not opposed to marriage equality in general. However, we simply think we first have to reform marriage before we take it. Registered partnership today is the better institution.
An Auckland, New Zealand, same-gender de facto couple has won a landmark ruling allowing them to apply to jointly adopt children. A high court judge agreed in late December that the phrase two spouses in the country's 1955 Adoption Act includes same-gender de facto couples, not just those who are legally married. Until now, New Zealand has only allowed qualified married couples or single people to adopt. Lawyer Stuart Daly successfully argued the case for the right for he and his partner to jointly adopt their two children, but the ruling applies to all same-gender de facto couples in New Zealand.
An Italian appeals court has upheld the right of a lesbian to adopt her partner's biological child. The two mothers in the case were married abroad and have lived in Rome since 2003. One conceived the child by artificial insemination, also outside Italy, and in August 2014, a youth court granted the second woman the right to adopt their daughter. That decision was overturned, but the appeals court ruling on December 23rd, upholding the adoption, cited the superior and preeminent interest of the child to maintain cohabitation and an affectionate relationship. Other Italian courts have authorized similar adoptions or have recognized those that took place in other countries since that original youth court decision in 2014.
In other news, charges have been dropped in the Southeast African nation of Malawi following an international outcry after two gay men were arrested in early December for private acts of consensual sodomy committed inside one of the defendants' homes. A police spokesman told the Malawi Times that after word of their liaison spread in the neighborhood, officers were simply protecting them from a volatile crowd that had started stoning the house, and that these two people's lives were in danger. But a bail document reportedly shows an arrest warrant for alleged sodomy. Other sources said that the two men suffered anal probes to test for homosexuality, a practice that has been condemned by almost every professional medical group on the planet as useless at best. Human rights groups have called it torture and a violation of international law.
But a Tunisian court sentenced six male students accused of sodomy to 3 years in prison on December 10th, which is the maximum under Article 230 of the nation's penal code. Police arrested the six men at the apartment of one of them, allegedly acting on a complaint by neighbors. They searched the house, seized computers, and took the men to a police station. Human Rights Watch said each of the defendants was anally probed to confirm his homosexuality and called the sentences in the northernmost country in Africa medieval and a gross invasion of their private life and bodily integrity.
and 11 men in Senegal were arrested in late December after allegedly attending a gay wedding outside the capital city of Dakar. In a December 26th report, the Associated Press cited a resident in the town who said that the 11 men were among 20 people attending the wedding that took place at a school in the town. He said the men remained in custody at the police station. Homosexual acts are punishable in the West African nation by up to 5 years in prison.
Elsewhere, supporters of a Personal Privacy Protection Act failed in their petition signature-gathering efforts to qualify the anti-transgender proposal for the November 2016 California ballot. It would have prohibited trans people from using facilities in government buildings that did not match their birth gender and would have virtually required the government to monitor bathroom use.
But a lawmaker in the state of Indiana has introduced a bill to criminalize trans people for using bathrooms and locker rooms corresponding to their gender identity. A trans-inclusive anti-discrimination bill was overturned by voters in Houston, Texas, in November, after a fear-mongering campaign warned about men in women's bathrooms. Similar transphobic efforts are expected to mushroom in the U.S. in 2016.
And finally, an ad in Australia was among the most complained about TV commercials of 2015. Lynx promoted its hair products by showing a man quickly kissing a woman and then a man, encouraging the viewer to experiment with their hair. Make the most of it, the announcer says, because now can be amazing. The Australian Advertising Standards Bureau dismissed the complaints, deciding that while some people might consider the male-male kiss bad behavior, the content of the ad did not breach the board's code of ethics. One of the complainants said he nearly fell off the lounge when he saw the man-on-man kiss. This ad seems to me to show the gay minority dictating terms to the normal majority. Another charged that it was part of the gay agenda forced into the home through ads.
That's News Wrap for the 3 weeks ending January 2nd, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Happy New Year!
Young love we share with deep emotion.
Hello, I'm Tab Hunter, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all of our sexually diverse communities.
It's time we get away to the movies and magic.
Our award-winning entertainment reporter Steve Pride is taking a different approach to his annual cinematic look back at the year just passed.
Hello, I'm Steve Pride, and this is Pride on Screen for the year that we just left behind. But rather than the usual countdown of my 10 favorite flicks, it's a sit-down with my two favorite folks from the year in film. It's two people, so it's in two parts. This week I talked with Kathy Wolf, founder of Wolf Video. Now celebrating her 30th year in the business, she pioneered LGBT film distribution in the 1980s, and now she releases as many as 15 titles a year into film festivals around the world and distributes an additional dozen onto DVD, Blu-ray, broadcast, streaming, and digital download.
I'm Kathy Wolf. I'm the owner and founder and CEO of Wolf Video.
How did you become the den mother of filmdom for the LGBT community?
That's such a cute word, den mother. You know, Steve, I just started. It wasn't something that I really preconceived that I'd be doing for 30 years. It sort of came out of personal desire to make a difference.
You have a master's in art.
Right. And I studied ceramics and glass blowing and sculpture and screen printing. I ended up teaching at the college level for about 8 years. Concurrently, I was building a small graphics business with a friend of mine. And at one point, I had to choose whether I was going to be a teacher or I was going to own a business. It was small at that point. Over the course of the next 18 years, it grew into a business that had 13 offices over five states and 150 employees. It was great in that regard, but honestly, it was not as fulfilling as you might think. And that was because my training was all in art. You can imagine at that point in the game, I was no longer doing art. I was doing things that I was completely untrained for, human resources and accounting. And it brought me to a place where I was very unhappy. And I really wanted to pull myself back into being an artist and working with artists. My partner did buy me out, so I had some seed money to follow this new interest of mine.
Tell me about the early days. Back then, we're talking VHS, right?
Absolutely, VHS. And honestly, Steve, when we very first started, not everybody even had a VHS player at home.
And there was no distribution model back then. You were lucky to find someone renting movies like that at all.
I actually had to create the LGBT distribution model. And I did that by getting a listing of all the gay and lesbian bookstores in North America. And I began by sending them all a letter saying that I had some movies that maybe they would like to open a rental section in their bookstore. It was actually a tremendous success. It was that relationship with the bookstores that really started me off, because they would say, well, these are great, but can you get me that K.D. Lang concert? And can you get something else that, you know, might be a mainstream studio release? Certainly, Steve, I could have said, no, I can't do that. But that's not who I am. I'm sort of this entrepreneur type. I said, sure, I'll do that. So I got in touch with mainstream distribution and started to become a sales agent for them. Within a very short amount of time, the numbers that we were creating in selling through Wolf to the bookstore market, they were starting to take notice that there is a huge untapped audience out there that really wants these movies. I remember in the early days, we would have a movie like Desert Hearts, for example. In those days, the sale price to a video store was $79. And I was selling those types of videos to individual people as well as the bookstores for rental. Some of our numbers were really impressive within the LGBT market.
Was it hard to find material?
No, it was not hard. As we started to become more and more successful, we would have filmmakers that were starting to take up video as a medium or convert their films to VHS. So we were starting to bring in, you know, a lot of kind of homemade projects that people found interesting, and that the LGBT video rental corner of their bookstore contained some pretty interesting stuff. Stuff you couldn't find elsewhere.
What was your biggest hit back in the day?
Back in the day? Well, our first release was a lesbian film called Everything Relative. We picked it up out of Sundance, and that actually was a very successful release.
As more people had VCRs, there was a transition from mom-and-pop video stores to corporate video chains. How did that impact you?
Well, now the story changes to us distributing into the mainstream with the content that we had. Our big break came in 1992 when Lily Tomlin was releasing her collection of five VHS tapes of her stand-up comedies and Ernestine and The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe. Lily was actually releasing this herself. She had not connected with a distributor. So she had all these VHS tapes and boxes and shipping department in her garage. I found out that she had this, and I thought, oh, I'm sure my bookstores would like this. So I had my partner, Maria Lynn, contact Lily's agent to see if we couldn't carry her VHS. And what transpired then was a complete turnabout in the whole future of our business. Lily decided she didn't want to be selling those VHS out of her garage anymore. She wanted a distributor that she could trust to do it for her. We had conversations about my company and my vision for the company, and she and Jane Wagner said, okay, we want you to distribute our stuff. This was a huge break for us. We took Lily to what was called the National Video Show, VSDA, in Las Vegas. We had a booth. We had so many people wanting to meet her. The line went all through the entire conference. The fire marshal had to come and help us move the line around so it wasn't creating a hazard. It was a huge, huge success. And at that point, we were not engaged with the national distributors, but now they had to bring in our stuff. So we opened accounts with Baker & Taylor, Ingram, Blockbuster, Hollywood Video, Tower Records, Fry's, every place that would be a direct distributor, plus the national distributors that took care of the 27,000 new video stores that were across the country. Now we were part of that. Lily helped us make that happen.
I remember rummaging through the LGBT film section at Blockbuster. Did you mind Wolf Films being ghettoized like that?
That's a topic that went back and forth. There was a time when we wanted to be just on the new release shelf with everybody else. And then we also felt the need to actually have our own section. So people that may not know the title could go to a section and discover the title. We ended up negotiating for both places. So we would try to be always on the new release shelf at Blockbuster. And in the cities that would have it, we would develop a section. Each city would name the section by their own comfort level. Sometimes it would be called community favorites. Sometimes it would just have a little pride flag. Sometimes it would be gay and lesbian.
This is Steve Pride, and we are talking to the founder of Wolf Video, Kathy Wolf. What were the big obstacles back in the day?
Well, the big obstacles really had to do with cash flow, really supporting this growing company with the money that I received from selling my other business. As you might expect, when you buy a $79 retail video, several hundred at a time, you have a cash flow issue. That was a concern. I ended up taking out several loans to carry the company. On a personal level, we were working in the basement of my home. So I had 8 to 9 people coming to work every day. We ended up converting the garage. We were shrink wrapping out in the patio. We had staff that were calling the bookstores and taking their orders and billing all that. And all this was concurrent with building our own mailing list because people would write us letters. And I'm telling you, Steve, in those days, people would say, we saved their life. They would write me letters saying, I never thought I would see anything like this in my local Blockbuster. You are making such a huge difference for us.
Talk about the impact of AIDS in the 80s and 90s. Your films meant so much to me back then.
Well, we did carry Common Threads, Stories of the Quilt. There were several notable films that really spoke to the AIDS crisis that we carried. And another thing happened here, which was we started to really build our men's following. Prior to that, we were really focusing on lesbian content. And we really started to build a following with men. And for the last 20 years, we've tried to cover all the content that we feel our customer base is looking for.
How has the business changed over these past 3 decades?
Well, you know, the expense of making a film has come way down with the advent of video and even nonlinear video editing. Now with digital video, we have a lot more content than we ever had in the early days. In the early days, when you made a movie, it was a big commitment. And so I think the movies were more substantial. Now we have a lot of movies that maybe we look at 10 to 15 movies a week, and we might distribute 12 to 15 a year. So there's a big amount of movies that really don't come up to our standards.
What do you look for in a film?
It's different than film festival programmers in that we have to find a film that people want to invest in. It has to have a certain commercial appeal. There are many films that I enjoy that I could never sell. And when we go into a theater to screen a film we have to put our commercial hat on and say, okay, will the community financially support this movie?
Now that you've shown everyone that LGBT film is a lucrative niche, has it become more competitive for you?
It has. There's some downsides to being successful and bringing in other distribution companies to compete with us is one of the offshoots of that. I do feel like we have an edge in that all of the companies use the same distribution networks. Everyone wants to be on Netflix and Hulu and iTunes and Amazon. Where we are special is the fact that we have 30 years of a mailing list and email list that we've built, 30 years of loyal customer base.
Kathy, I've loved talking with you today. Is there anything we've missed?
The one thing that we should talk about is how we've become more of an international company.
Okay.
Just in the last 3 years, we've developed more international exposure for Wolf because of wolfondemand.com. And that's made us aware of communities around the world. And every month I get a report on who's watching, from what country. It's never a surprise to know that the United States is number one and Canada and Mexico. But as they fall out from there, sometimes it's like Pakistan or Saudi Arabia. We know we are reaching a much broader audience. And in some ways, we know that audience. It's where the United States was 30 years ago. And it really feels very comfortable for us to be supporting those people in their struggles. There are people in parts of Africa that tell us they gather in a basement with the windows all boarded up and they download some of our movies on their computer, but it's a complete big secret. Even their families don't know they're gay. They don't know why they're there. They don't know why they're in the basement every week.
What are your hopes for Wolf going forward?
Of course, I would like to know that the company continues to support the LGBT community. That's not a given, I must say. We've gone through some really hard times, some difficult transitions going from VHS to DVD to Blu-ray to streaming to, like, who knows what's next. I think there'll be films on Wolf on Demand that ultimately you will not be able to find anywhere else. So I hope that Wolf continues to be a resource for our content for many years to come.
This has been a conversation with Kathy Wolf, founder of Wolf Video. Find out more about her company and her films at Wolf with an E, video.com.
They said we have to tab you something, so that's how tab came about.
Join us next week for a visit with Hollywood legend, Tab Hunter, and the conclusion of Pride on Screen 2015. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, John Dyer V, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Brian Wilson with Van Dyke Parks and Alan Williams performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, wonderful new video for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws CD, and even more at thiswayout.org. Email TWORadio at AOL.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Dade City Community Radio, Dade City, Florida, to CHR Cessnock, New South Wales, KRCC, Colorado Springs, Colorado, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, highlights from a year of social and political commentary and analysis. I'm CS. We'll present excerpts of six interviews in 2015 that I thought stood out on the topics of romantic love, alienation, black lives, precarity, the middle class, personalized education, and systemic change, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It's my habit every January to go back through the interviews I conducted on this program over the past year and to present portions of conversations I found especially illuminating or provocative. This hour you'll hear from six thinkers: Mitch Mansour on romantic love in this age of social alienation, Frank Wilderson III on blacks and the master-slave relation, Maribel Casas Cortez on the notion of precarity, Alex Casnabish on the myth of the middle class, Christopher Newfield on personalized education, and Albena Osmanova on systemic change. We begin with Mitch Mansour, a PhD student in the Department of Sociology at the University of Oregon, whose dissertation has the title Together and Alone, Intimacy and Alienation in the Age of Hyper-Individualism. After Mitch told me about the increasing social isolation and alienation experienced by people in the U.S., I posed this question. So people are becoming more socially isolated, and yet, as you write, humans, human beings, are at their essence social beings, and they are also, humans are also characterized by their ability to adapt. So how have they adapted, in your mind, to their increasing social isolation?
Well, in my mind, the adaptation has been towards the idealization of romantic love, the increasing idealization. Certainly, romantic love has been around for at least a century, and it's become more and more dominant, I think, as the years have progressed. And once again, I can't, you know, find empirical evidence for that, but I believe that to be the case. And so as communities disappear, as people interact with less and less people, they need to have some way to feel connected to others. They need to have some way to meet their emotional and material needs. And once, you know, people become more and more isolated, well, they need some way to do that. And romantic love seems to be the solution, that if they can just find that one person, you know, the idea of the expression, you know, two against the world, you know, if they can find that one person they can connect with and that will, you know, be at their side and look after them and they can look after them, the other person, that will be a solution to the lack of community. You create a community of two, in essence.
What has the anthropologist Charles Lindholz said about the kinds of societies in which romantic love can be found?
So he argues that romantic love is generally only found in competitive individualistic societies where you can't develop intimate relations based on mutuality because of the nature of competitive individualism, where everyone's out there competing in a marketplace looking out for their own self-interest. And that's as true for material needs as it is for psychological needs, like attention, for example. He doesn't talk about this, but another author, Charles Derber, in The Pursuit of Attention, which I didn't cite in this particular article, But he talks about the idea that even in conversation, in daily interaction with friends or coworkers, if you put a group of people together, they feel the need to compete for attention, that not everyone's paid attention to equally or listened to or appreciated. And reality television is sort of like an extension of that, where the average person can then find other ways of competing for attention or going on Facebook or other social media. So even our emotional needs are not met in a competitive, individualistic society. And so therefore, romantic love becomes a solution as a result of that.
And there's an irony you also cite in this paper, which is that once a romantic relationship becomes the replacement for the lack of community, then one's focus on one's romantic partner does something to the ability to one's ability to build community and social connection with friends, neighbors, and others. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So romantic love is seen as a solution to the lack of community. You create a community of two or however, you know, you're the immediate family if you have children. But because you put so much time and energy into that relationship, and also because, I mean, if you look at Americans specifically, I mean, we work an average of 53, 54 hours a week. So people don't have a lot of free time. And they're under a lot of psychological and economic stress, so that they decide, well, I don't have a lot of time to build community. I don't have time to spend, you know, to talk to my neighbors or develop, you know, civic organizations. And so they put all that energy into the romantic relationship in that immediate family environment. But because of that, and it's a reasonable thing to do from the perspective of the individual, but as a result of that, they don't really have time then to build community. And if they had built, if they were able to build real community where, you know, everyone was looking out for one another, it wouldn't be as necessary to idealize romantic love in the romantic relationship in the nuclear family, as it were.
So people want intimacy. They desire intimacy. To some degree, they need intimacy, partly, as you said earlier, as a replacement for, you know, the social support that is no longer there, or the fulfillment via community that is no longer there. And yet you argue in your paper and your dissertation that people lack the ability to create intimate relationships. Here you bring up a term called romantic contradiction. What does that mean?
So what it means is that on the one hand, because of the social conditions, the isolation that people feel, and the physical isolation they experience, romantic love is idealized. But at the same point in time, those cultural conditions that promote the rise of romantic love also undermine the ability to create relationships based on intimacy and mutual support. And I think the core of it really is you know, back to competitive individualism, you know, the idea that people in a competitive individualistic society look out for their interests first, and they see others as a way to realize those interests, whether they be material or psychological. And so if you approach your relationship based on what do I get out of this, it's kind of hard to build a sense of intimacy or mutuality. In fact, it's the very opposite of that, and it's going to be at odds with what your claimed goals are.
So does the romantic contradiction, Mitch, does it mean that many relationships end up in disappointment? And if so, and I think I know the answer to that, what do people do? Do they give up on the search?
So to answer the first question, yes, it does end up in disappointment in different ways. I mean, first, most relationships, I mean, you know, most people can realize that just by their own personal experience or observing others, most relationships fail. And fail by I mean end at some point, whether it's a few months or a few years, they generally end at some point. Most people do not expect to honestly be with their partner indefinitely. And divorce rates, I don't remember what the divorce rate is at the moment, but it's reasonably high. So relationships generally are going to end, even though we want these relationships to go throughout our lifetime. That's the goal. People kind of know that they're going to end. But even the relationships that do are sustained for a period of time, there's obviously a lot of dissatisfaction within these relationships. A lot of times there's violence, either emotional violence or physical violence, particularly physical violence against women, you know, domestic violence. So there's a lot of negative things that happen in these relationships or unfulfilled needs in these relationships, and they generally end. To answer the second question, people do not, in fact, give up despite these disappointments, despite the relationships ending, despite having negative experiences, because they're so dependent on the romantic relationship to transcend the alienation and isolation they experience, they're left in an even more vulnerable state when the relationship ends. And, you know, we have a term for it, you know, the rebound relationship, where people immediately try to latch onto somebody else, because being alone is even more painful than it was prior to the relationship, because there's a sort of dependency that develops within these relationships, even if they're not necessarily healthy or fulfilling. Nevertheless, they provided the individual with something. And so when they're left alone again, there's a desperate need for most people to sort of find another partner so they can sort of fill that void, because they don't have the community once again. You know, I think ultimately part of the reason I'm exploring this topic in my dissertation is that I want to sort of shed light on the idea that we need to do more than simply pursue romantic relationships, that we need more than a community of two. And if we improve our relationships with people more generally, well, our relationships, you know, our intimate relationships, our romantic relationships, will undoubtedly improve as well. They go hand in hand to some extent. But the other thing is, you know, forgetting the building larger community for a second, because that requires social change, you know, that requires organizing, that's more than the individual by themselves can do. Nevertheless, it should be seen as a, you know, a goal for us to reach and something to keep our minds on and to start discussion with other people. But the individual can still, within their own relationships, there's their own romantic relationships, start thinking more about, well, how do I contribute to this problem? How can I be a more loving person versus how do I be more lovable and likable? And it takes a great deal of self-reflection, and that's not something that's done, you know, overnight or in a week or a month or a year even. It's an ongoing process of self-reflection. So I think the individual can do quite a bit if they're thinking about these things in a self-reflexive way, beyond just changing the social structure. But ultimately, you know, as a radical, I would like to say we should probably be working towards building a different society based on alternative values. We should be building real community, which is the idea that we have an obligation to other people. We don't simply spend time with people because we find them interesting or because they're useful to us, but because we have a responsibility towards them. And if we feel a responsibility towards others, perhaps we can encourage them to then, you know, reciprocate that feeling. And we won't be alone and isolated anymore. So we can improve our individual relationships, but we also have to start thinking about how do we change our society? What types of values do we want to impart in the larger society? And how do we accomplish that?
That's Mitch Mansour, doctoral candidate in sociology at the University of Oregon. His dissertation examines intimacy and alienation in what he calls the age of hyper-individualism. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We turn next to Frank Wilderson III, who's created quite a stir with his theorization of Black experience and existence in the context of the master-slave relation. Frank Wilderson is professor of African American Studies and Drama at the University of California, Irvine. His books include Incognegro, A Memoir of Exile and Apartheid, and Red, White, and Black, Cinema and the Structure of U.S. Antagonisms. Here's Frank talking about a way of thinking called Afro-pessimism.
What Afro-pessimism, the conceptual lens or framework that myself and other people are working on, assumes is that you have to begin with an analysis of slavery that corrects the heretofore thinking about it. So the first thing that happens, and this is built upon the work of Orlando Patterson, his 1982 tome, Slavery and Social Death. The first thing that we have to do is screw our heads on backwards. In other words, to stop defining slavery through the experience of slaves. So that what happens normally is that people think of slavery as forced labor and people in chains. And what Orlando Patterson does is he says that what slavery really is social death. In other words, that social death defines the relation between the slave and all others. And that forced labor is an example of the experience that slaves might have. Not all slaves were forced to work. So if you then move by saying that slavery is social death, by definition, this is our foundational definition. What is social death? Social death has three constituent elements. One is gratuitous violence, which means that the body of the slave is open to the violence of all others. Whether he or she receives that violence or not, he or she exists in a state of structural or open vulnerability. This vulnerability is not contingent upon his or her transgressing some type of law, as in going on strike with the worker. The other point is that the slave is natally alienated, which is to say that the temporality of one's life that is manifest in filial and affilial relations, the capacity of families and the capacity to have associative relations, may exist very well in your head. You might say, I have a father, I have a mother. But in point of fact, the world does not recognize or incorporate your filial relations into its understanding of family. And the reason that the world can do this goes back to point number one, because you exist in a regime of violence which is gratuitous, open, and you are openly vulnerable to everyone else, not a regime of violence which is contingent upon you being a transgressed worker or a transgressing woman or someone like that. And the third is general dishonor, which is to say that you are dishonored in your very being. And I think that this is the nature of blackness with everyone else. You're dishonored prior to your performance of dishonored actions. So if this is it takes a long time to build this, but in a nutshell, that's it. And so if that thing, that's one of the moves of Afro-pessimism, if you take that move and then you take out property relations, someone who's owned by someone else, you take that out of the definition of slavery, and you take out forced labor, and you replace that with social death and those three constituent elements and a lot of other things, what you have is a continuum of slave-like or slavery subjugation that black people exist in. And 1865 is a blip on the screen. It is not a paradigmatic moment. It's an experiential moment, which is to say that the technology of enslavement simply morphs and shapeshifts. It doesn't end with that.
If, as Orlando Patterson, who is a sociologist at Harvard, if he argues that forced labor is not a defining characteristic of slavery, if he says that naked violence is sort of one of the key elements, as you said, of social death, which is slavery, and if the violence directed at blacks is not based on, as you said, this person transgressing in some way, being disobedient in some way, refusing to consent in some way to what the ruling class thinks or does, then why is violence freely directed at blacks? What is the reason that the non-white or the master in the master-slave relation treats blacks violently?
The short answer is that violence against the slave is integral to the production of that psychic space called social life. So that the repetitive nature of violence against the slave does not have the same type of utility that violence against a post-colonial subject has. In other words, to, in the first instance, to secure and maintain the occupation of land. And it does not have the utility of violence against the working class, which would be to secure and maintain the extraction of surplus value and the wage. We have to think more libidinally and in a more robust fashion. This is where it becomes really, really controversial and really troubling for a lot of people, because what Patterson is arguing and what people like myself and Professor Jarrett Sexton and Cydia Hartman at Columbia University have extended is to say that what we need to do is begin to think of violence not as having essentially the kind of political or economic utility that violence in other revolutionary paradigms have. Violence against the slave sustains a kind of psychic stability for all others who are not slaves.
When you say that, and I've read some of your writings on this subject, it seems like you're suggesting that only if some population perceives another population as inferior or so degraded that anything can be done to them, unless they have that other in mind, that somehow psychologically and psychically they can't have the integrity that they want. Is that correct? And why would that be the case psychologically? Why would somebody need to have some other person seen in that light in order to feel actualized, in order to feel worthy of life?
It's a very good question, and we could spend another couple hours on it. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to give you kind of shorthand answers that have integrity, and hopefully your listeners will do some more reading and research to see actually how these mechanisms work. But let's take it for 1 second outside of the way in which I and other Afro-pessimists are theorizing it, which is to say that blackness cannot be, one of our claims, blackness cannot be disimbricated from slaveness. And that's a very controversial claim, because it's actually, that claim is actually the fault lines right now of African and black studies across the country, the claim that blackness and slaveness cannot be disimbricated, cannot be pulled apart. But I can't argue against everyone who disagrees with that right now. But let's just say that one of the points that Patterson makes at a large or higher scale of abstraction is that the concept of community and the concept of freedom and the concept of kind of communal and personal and interpersonal presence actually needs a conceptual antithesis. In other words, you can't think community without being able to register non-community. So his point is that because this book, Slavery and Social Death, goes back thousands of years, and it goes thinks of slavery in China and all over the world. And he says that communal coherence has a lot of positive attributes. This is my language. This is how I organize my polity. These are the anthropological accoutrements of how we work our customs. But at the end of the day, what it needs to know is what it is not. And so the idea of freedom and the idea of communal life and the idea of civic relations has to have a kind of point of attention, which is absent of that or different than that. And this is the function that slavery presents or provides to coherence. So that prior to Columbus, for example, the Choctaw might have someone inside a Choctaw community who transgresses the codes of the community so fiercely that they're given a choice. And the choice at the moment of this kind of transgression, which is beyond the beyond, is between real death, we will kill you and stop breathing, like execution, or social death. Nothing changes in the mind of that person tomorrow, the day after he or she chooses social death. He or she still thinks that they have a cosmology, that they have intimate family relations. But the point that Patterson is making is that everything changes in the structure of that person's dynamic with the rest of the tribe, so that now that person is a slave, that person is socially dead. This is bad for that person, obviously, but what he is suggesting is that that type of action regenerates the knowledge of our existence for everyone else. Now, where I and some others take Patterson further is to say that blackness, and even the thing called Africa, cannot be disimbricated, cannot be pulled apart from that smaller scale process that he talks about with respect to Chinese communities or the Choctaw. In other words, that there was a global consensus that Africa is the location of sentient beings who are outside of global community, who are socially dead. And that global consensus begins with the Arabs in 625, and it's passed on to the Europeans in 1452. Prior to that global consensus, you can't think black. You can think Buganda, Ashanti, and Ndebele. You can think many different cultural identities. But blackness cannot be disimbricated from the global consensus that decides that here is a place which is emblematic of that moment that the Choctaw person is spun out from social life to social death. That's part of the foundation.
Well, this is very provocative. Are you saying then that, let's just focus on the U.S., are you saying that every African-American, regardless of income or wealth or status, can and should be understood in the figure of this slave who is socially dead in relation to the master who I presume is white?
Well, the master is everyone else. Whites and their junior partners, which are, in my book, colored immigrants. It's just that colored immigrants exist in an intra-human status of degradation in relation to white people. They're degraded as humans, but they still exist paradigmatically in that position of the human. So, yes, I am saying that.
Frank Wilderson III is his name. He's a professor of African American Studies and Drama at the University of California, Irvine. I'm CS, and today I'm looking back at some of the most interesting and revealing interviews I was fortunate enough to conduct in 2015. Next up is Maribel Casas Cortez, an independent researcher affiliated with the Geography Department at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Maribel has been studying how precarity, a noun that goes with precarious, how precarity has been used as a concept and a rallying point by a great many people in Europe struggling for better, more secure lives in the face of neoliberal anti-labor policies. I asked her how migrants in and to Europe might be seen to fit within the rubric of precarity in a way that builds solidarity with other marginalized people.
The migrant, given its legal status and questions of racism, becomes the epitome of precarity. If precarity refers to uncertain and secure, the migrant becomes, this is it. This is insecurity ad nauseam, right? So precarity folks started to be very interested in that figure, almost idealizing it, like, is this the new, you know, revolutionary subject? No, I'm joking. But there was a lot of interest in that figure because of that vulnerable position, not only in their journey to the country, but also when they work, when they move in the city, all those constant checkpoints that they have to go through because of their legal status. And so, but at the same time, this interest created a lot of solidarity movements with migrants, but from a very, so to speak, almost like you and me, and somehow victimizing that population that otherwise was very active itself, organizing like sans-papier movements, the without papers movements, locking themselves in churches and doing all those kind of hunger strikes, reinforcing somehow this idea that the border was there to stop populations. So it was not until the precarity struggles in Germany, they started to talk about migration in a totally different way that was very empowering for both locals and migrants. Looking at the migrant as, hey, we are finding a lot of commonalities between us. We ourselves, the locals, are becoming migrants somehow. Like the new labor conditions are calling us, all of us, to move more, to be, let's see, I'm going to just read you this nice quote from one of the movements. We are hireable on demand, available on call, exploitable at will, and fireable at whim. We all share that positionality of being so vulnerable at work. Why don't we fight from this commonality? Of course, addressing the differences among ourselves, but that allows for a horizontality between the two populations that was very fruitful. And the precarity struggles, in that sense, become richer and with unexpected alliances.
Later in the interview, Maribel Casas Cortez addressed the issue of what some feminists, have done with the concept of precarity.
Well, there was a moment that precarity struggles became in fashion and almost a new identity was created, like the precariat, and I am a precariat, and it referred to those cognitariat workers, those knowledge workers, or those migrants in temporary contracts. But then the feminists wanted to contribute, saying, well, what about all those invisibilized sectors that have been in precarious conditions for a long time, but they have not received the theoretical attention or even the political importance that they deserve, like the domestic sector or communicative kind of jobs such as the call center labor and the reproductive sector. So in a way, it's like the concept of precarity stretches beyond the realm of production to go to those corners of where life is being reproduced. And this is a very key contribution to understand that precarity, rather than an exclusive identity or a concrete analytical point, is rather a process. The feminists try to point that out, and they call it the precarization of existence, that somehow all those corners of our everyday life are being subsumed by this logic of profit, and that precarity should be always considered as beyond the workspace.
We've talked a lot about what the concept of precarity is being used to embrace, and we have all these different elements in society, all these different populations, not just, of course, the traditional working person. So what value, as we begin to wrap up, what value do you see the concept of precarity having? What do Europeans see as its potential for harnessing certain energies into maybe a unified or somewhat cohesive social movement?
My argument, what I want to stress, is that precarity acts as a toolbox concept in the sense that allows for a resubjectification, let's put it this way. Like, if you go through a temporary contract and jumping from one place to another, you develop a sense of isolation and frustration and resignation that through the concept of precarity, you are able to overcome, in the sense that you start seeing commonalities with other kinds of workers and you start communicating those common threats, and precarity somehow is useful for getting over this identity politics of privilege versus poor, I'm middle class, I'm not affected by what is going on right now. So we can see it in the U.S., all this discourse about the 99%, we are the 99%, that speaks to that openness of the concept of precarity. It might include a larger sector of the population. You might be doing pizzas, I might be doing research, other people might be doing calls from a calling center, but all of us are being affected by the increasing lack of labor rights, lowering of labor protections. So precarity for me allows for this queering of very strict categories that didn't allow for alliances and a process of even to look at yourself differently and to organize collectively.
Precarity isn't a popular concept, a familiar concept to that many people in this country. Why do you think that is? Why hasn't precarity been a rallying point of social movements and activists in the U.S.?
Well, I would say that social movements in the U.S. are extraordinarily developed in notions such as gender, race, queer politics, but the issue of class, somehow there is a handicap here with movements. And I have seen that being active in different movements, from the Direct Action Network in Chicago to teaching assistant organization at the university. The question of class is not developed, because there is this national myth that being American is being part of this middle class. And this mythical middle class is based on debt many times, right? But it's still, you're a middle class. And there is a big then break with those that are poor and very miserable. So that is a very hard identification to break in.
That's the voice of Maribel Casas Cortez, a researcher affiliated with the Department of Geography at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Maribel's comments about the middle class serve as a nice segue into comments made by Alex Kasnabish in an interview last year on Against the Grain. Alex Kasnabish is Associate Professor of Sociology and Anthropology at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And he's co-author with Max Haven of The Radical Imagination, Social Movement Research in the Age of Austerity. Alex here was speaking to me about the crisis fueled by, among other things, neoliberal austerity-oriented regimes, the so-called war on terror, and environmental catastrophe.
The thing that is remarkable about it, perhaps, is that that sense of crisis has extended to groups previously insulated from it. So, for example, those forms of crisis which, you know, have been borne by people who have been marginalized by the systems, overlapping systems like capitalism, patriarchy, white supremacy, who are used to dealing, perhaps, with these forms of crisis. Now it's the middle class, or the perhaps inappropriately named middle class, this kind of intermediate class of actors in society who previously believed that by playing along and doing what they needed to do, by playing by the rules of the system, that they would be insulated from the crises plaguing other peoples. And of course, that's no longer true in all kinds of places. In the country that I live in right now, for example, in Canada, the governor of the Bank of Canada recently told young people looking for work that there wasn't any and that they should commit themselves to working for free for an indefinite period of time once they enter the workplace. And if that's not a crisis of the general operation of capitalism, I don't know what is. I mean, telling the white middle class that it should expect to basically be completely exploited is a pretty fundamental recognition that we live in crisis-ridden times. So I think at that very basic level, we see crisis all around us. We see ecological crisis, economic crisis, political and social crisis as the mounting costs of the way we have organized our world, particularly around an economic system driven by crisis and infinitely productive of it, is simply reaching its apogee.
So how powerfully has this middle class imaginary, if you will, been held out by the system as a way of transcending or protecting oneself from crisis? And what happened to that imaginary in the 1970s?
Well, I think that critics or social observers like me, academics and more popular folks looking at these issues, have long undersold the way that mythologies, control mythologies, work in a social and cultural sense to discipline us and to craft our understandings of what is possible and what we should expect in the world. And for a long time, and I mean, I think somebody like Chris Hedges has commented on this in a really accessible way in his book Bemoaning the Death of the Liberal Class, and his recognition in that book, which I mean, I think I would share, that the middle class has always been a mythological formation, mythological in the sense not that it's untrue or fake, but that it's a central orienting story within the larger logic of capitalism, particularly in places like the global north, which have disproportionately benefited from the pillaging of other peoples in other parts of the world, of course, as well as marginalized peoples within its own borders. So I think that myth of the middle class, this idea that by playing along, by being a good obedient worker, a good obedient citizen, a well-disciplined individual in society who pays his or her bills, who gets the right kind of job, who you know, goes to the right kind of schools and engages in the right kinds of activities outside of our work and schooling lives, that will guarantee you more or less the ability not to live a life marked by fundamental precarity is no longer true. So I think we need to understand that myth has always been used as a horizon to orient people's imaginations of why bother participating, why bother giving into a system that basically is predicated on you working a whole hell of a lot and other people benefiting tremendously from that labor. So that's the horizon of the middle class. And Barbara Ehrenreich, in a great little piece published a couple of years ago, pointed to this, saying, you know, why do we continue to even use this term? There's no such thing as the middle class. Really, we should be talking about the existence or the creation of what she calls the professional managerial class, this intermediate class essentially between the proletariat and capitalists, this class of workers who have been privileged by their intermediate position, who exercise a certain amount of control over the lives of workers below them and yet clearly aren't capitalists. These are people like me in many cases. These are academics, journalists, artists, social workers, other forms of sort of social technicians who for a long time constituted this backbone to capitalism, right? And not just occupying important technical roles within the operation of a capitalist society, but actually operating as these kinds of quasi-aspirational figures within that system. People who got by simply, you know, getting along and paying their dues. And this was, I think, this is a central myth that grew out of the welfare state as well, right? That people's struggles against fully predatory capitalism in the early 20th century, the strength of those struggles gave birth to a ruling class response that was essentially the welfare state. If we can't repress you, if we can't defeat you, then we will try to co-opt you and buy you off and demobilize you. And there were definitely gains. That's not to suggest that there weren't gains won in that period. Of course, there were. Those gains were won out of popular struggle. But as soon as it was efficacious for ruling elites to abandon that, which happens in the 1960s, of course, then we see a full-on war declared against the working class. Again, and the working class thought of broadly as anybody who labors. We're not just talking about, you know, sort of white male factory workers. We're talking about anybody who works for a wage or not within the capitalist system. And since the 60s, across the global north, we've seen an attack on the so-called middle class, an attack on the ability of wages to keep pace with inflation, just as one simple indicator of that, for example. But I think more broadly, that what's so interesting is that myth has endured, and it endures even today in many sectors of society, with the idea that, again, if we are obedient, if we are disciplined, if we play along, if we support the system as it stands, then at some point we will also be beneficiaries of it. We will be protected from its worst excesses. And I think that that is one of the most pernicious myths in many ways. Max and I write about this in the book, that in fact, in the global north, it's one of the most powerful demobilizing tools in the arsenal of the ruling class.
Alex Kasnabish, co-author of The Radical Imagination, teaches sociology and anthropology at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax, Canada. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And I have two more voices to share with you today as we look back on some of the more compelling interviews I was a part of in 2015. Christopher Newfield is professor of literature and American studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the author of Unmaking the Public University. At one point in our conversation, I asked Christopher Newfield about a mode of education he strongly supports, a way of nurturing young people that he calls directed independent study.
Well, it's where you find out what a student's deep interest is, you know, what their issue is, what problem in the world they want to solve, and then you help put them in the position where they can solve it. You know, you give them the knowledge, the research base, but also really more importantly, the practices and the engagement with that, the habits of thinking, the forms of discipline that will allow them to succeed at this. I mean, I didn't really understand this until I ironically went to France as I was the University of California's study center director in Lyon for 3 years for exchange students from all of the UC campuses, including Berkeley. And I was responsible for helping students take their French university courses and get credit for them at their UC campus. And I thought that was going to be a fairly straightforward process. And it turned out that the mixture of courses that they were taking didn't really make any sense to me. You know, I would ask them, well, why did you take this course in, you know, sort of Mesopotamian cultural systems, and then another course on the politics of oil in the contemporary Middle East, and then a third course on, you know, the development of East Asian economics in the 16th century. And they said, well, I need one from column A and two from column B and three from column C. And those are the courses that were available. So I backed them up. I started an advising program. I would say, well, why are you in college? You know, what are you really trying to study? And they would say, well, I'm a global studies major. I would say, well, I know that, but why are you a global studies major? And they would say, well, I want to go to law school. And I would say, well, that's not really what I'm asking you. That's fine. But what in global studies is answering a question that you want to have answered? What's your intellectual interest in college? And that was probably the worst phrase that I've ever used with a student, intellectual interest. 90% of them just looked completely blank. And so we would work through it, and they came up with these amazing things once they first understood what I was asking them, and then secondly, were given a real opportunity to think about that.
Yeah, some of the students told you they'd never been asked that question before.
Yeah, I mean, I was amazed. You know, nobody in their family, none of their friends, and none of their professors, none of their teachers in K through 12, because we're basically just trying to move them through material. And we're not thinking so much about, first, whether they're learning it in the most effective way, but then secondly, what do you do with stuff that you've learned in your life? And, you know, I mean, my feeling is that education is really the transformative human capability. I mean, humans are pretty horrible instinctively, and the capacity for violence and destruction that we have without these kinds of products of education, without those tools, is just horrific. And we're not going to make it if we can't get mass creativity on a kind of a global scale. I mean, that's my basic gut feeling about all of this and why I'm, you know, so committed to, you know, sort of restoring the quality of public universities that have been having such a hard time in the last 30 years.
So can you give me an example of a student who maybe after a few conversations did come up with their intellectual interest and how you worked with that person to foster that, to help them engage more with that interest?
Yeah, there was an architecture student from UCLA who was kind of dumbfounded by Lyon and also by my question of her intellectual interest, because they're, you know, she was doing an architecture sort of pre-professional track because she wanted to be an architect. And so I said, well, how do you feel about Lyon as a city? So we talked for a while, and she said, well, what I really notice is that the different neighborhoods don't fit together. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, this arrondissement here, it's not just that the buildings are different and newer, it's that the street grids don't even match up. And I said, well, that's a really interesting question. So figure it out if you're interested enough in it to really research. And she was. And so she went through a process of learning the history of the development of the city of Lyon. She spoke to city planners and other people that helped her with documents. She ended up putting the topic was, why is Lyon this weird mishmash when Paris is not? The thesis was these different regions were controlled by different sort of ruling groups at different times, and they had these very distinct theories of how you organize cities that were still visible in the city. She wrote a thesis about this. She presented it later to some city officials who gave her sort of a little award for being the first foreign student to ever explain their city to them. And then she went back to UCLA and, you know, got her degree in pre-architecture and now is studying architecture. So the question is, well, why is that different from her just having done well in her classes and gone on to architecture school? And for me, there's a couple of things. One is she developed an ability to interrogate a situation that, you know, was mysterious and opaque to her. In other words, just not just taking it for granted, but seeing, you know, something outside of her as a kind of a mystery that she herself could individually solve. So there's a form of empowerment there that I think is intrinsically valuable. And then the second thing had to do with the content. She developed an understanding of the relationship between social formation, you know, in the form of merchants over here and silk people over there and the 19th century owners of early corporations over there, that then allowed her to understand that the way that social elites affect public space, and that will in turn then feed back into the way that she designs buildings in her career in cities that are shaped by conflicting social forces. So I think what it did was it made her potentially an architect on a more creative, higher, more interactive level, one that can work with different kinds of interests and not just the individual client, one that can see the ensemble, you know, the full social context, and can think about how to design buildings that will answer that. I think she's going to be a sustainable architect and do sustainability because of this historical understanding of the multiplicity of forces that affect particular buildings.
That's Christopher Newfield, professor of literature and American studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And finally, we bring you brief comments by Albena Osmanova. Albena is an associate professor in social and political thought at the University of Kent's Brussels School of International Studies in Belgium. She's also the author of The Scandal of Reason, a critical theory of political judgment. Here, Albena Osmanova takes up the question of piecemeal reform versus structural and systemic change.
Take the critique of capitalism that we inherited from Marx and Georg Lukács. There are two trajectories in which Marx describes oppression and domination and injustice. The injustice of exploitation. The worker is weaker vis-a-vis the capitalist because the worker doesn't have the resources, doesn't have the ownership of the means of production. So this is what I call relational inequality. Some people have less power than others, so they're unequal within a certain model of well-being. But Marx also wrote about alienation, and this is not the same logic in which people suffer, because alienation is brought about by the submission of absolutely everybody, even of those who own the means of production, the capitalists, the bourgeoisie, the enemy. Even these people are submitted to the productivist imperative and pressures of capitalism. So when Marx describes that alternative way of being, when you are in the morning a fisherman and you're a worker in the afternoon and you're an intellectual in the evening, this model of having a fuller life, that means that we need changes both on the level of the relational but also on what I call the systemic logic. So these calls of Occupy movements against inequality, the cause of the 99% against the privileges of the 1%, calls against austerity, calls for women's equality with men on the labor market. These are very valid, very important calls for equality within certain model of well-being. But what we need and what it's time, and I believe it's really, we have the means to do it now, if more than any time before, is to question the whole model of well-being. We're ready.
Albena Osmanova teaches social and political thought at the University of Kent's Brussels School of International Studies. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
Wisconsin Nature Notes from the Nature Conservancy. What is singing, blooming, creeping, and crawling in the Badger State?
In winter, most of Wisconsin's bald eagles migrate to where the food is. And the best ice-free restaurants are near dams and power plants where open water abounds. Because so many eagles congregate at these sites, eagle-watching events are now held on the Mississippi River in Cassville, Prairie du Chien, and Ferryville, on the Wisconsin River in Sauk Prairie, and along the Fox River at numerous locations between Nina and Kaukauna. Today, bald eagles are absolutely flourishing in Wisconsin, but it wasn't always this way. In 1782, America adopted the bald eagle as its symbol. That year, the eagle population crashed from an estimated 100,000 nesting pairs in the continental United States to only 487 nesting pairs in the late 1960s. Between 1968 and 1973, along the 260-mile stretch of the Upper Mississippi National Wildlife Refuge, there was just one nesting pair. In 1969, it became clear that DDT was linked to the eagle's profound population decline, and Wisconsin became one of the first states to ban DDT, helping to trigger a national ban in 1972. It's been an amazing turnaround ever since. Eagles steadily increased in number after steps were taken to protect them. They were removed from Wisconsin's endangered species list in 1997 and from the federal list in 2007. By 2013, the last year for which we have a complete count, a record 1,343 occupied eagle nests were documented in 67 of Wisconsin's 72 counties. Sauk Prairie began the tradition of designating a winter weekend for watching these amazing congregations of eagles. This year marks Sauk Prairie's 29th annual Bald Eagle Watching Days. It takes place on January 15th and 16th. If you've never seen dozens of eagles in one area intent on giving you a great lesson in how to catch fish, this is your chance. Don't wait too long, either. By late February, many adult eagles will be returning to their nesting sites. There, on average, they will lay their eggs by April 1st. Learn how you can take part in conservation in Wisconsin. Go to Nature Conservancy's website at nature.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Nature Notes is the work of the Nature Conservancy in Wisconsin and Mind's Eye Audio in Madison.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.